basically two essential strategies, and we were kind of talking about it here for a second. So let's review that, because we are headed into the character we call the Tantric or Tantrika Ganapati, the Ganesha Ganapati, and we haven't even really touched on that yet. But to understand this distinction, we have to go to something a little more fundamental, and that is to say, what kind of a world of yoga do they live in, and what are their practices for? So let's take up two basic words and move it through. Yoga simply means the way the world engages you and the way you engage the world. That's all it means. Simply, exactly. So the world engages you and you engage the world. Now you can be more and less attentive to that. You can be more and less engaged in the process. But whether you like it or not, or whether you know it or not, you're involved in what the texts usually simply call yoga. Yoga means you were yoked to the world, literally yoked, right? Because you were severed from the world. You were pushed out of a womb and cut from a cord and given this extraordinary gift. And that separation actually yoked you because it bound you to life and death. What you do about it is called sadhana. So yoga isn't your practice. Your practice is called sadhana. The word sadhana comes from either two different verbal roots. So it either means a process or it means a goal, but it doesn't really kind of much matter. It means the methods and the strategies and the efforts and the instruments through which you engage the world, because the world is already engaging you. So think of sadhana simply as practice. And you can think of yourself as practicing. And you think of the accomplished yogi as well, we used to do it when I went to graduate school. So I'd walk to the yard to go into the library, just as the sun was rising. I would leave after the sun set, because that's the life of a graduate student in my world. So did you ever hear that story about the Harvard Sanskrit PhD student who had a date? Did you ever hear that story? Neither did I. I never heard that date either. I never heard that story either. So that was my life. So, but we'd walk across the yard, and there would be this like rather lovely guy walking across the yard carrying a cello case. And we actually really did this. We yelled, "Yo mama." And he would wave back because it was Yo-Yo Ma. And he's walking from where he lived, which was over where I lived on the other side of the design school, through the yard to the practice rooms, which were down by the river. And he would disappear all day. Because you know how he got good? He practiced all day. Exactly. So sadhana is simply staying in the game. And virtuosity and becoming yourself is the best kind of yoga. It's making something difficult look easy, and that has to do with living. Okay, so now we have to understand a kind of a meta point, a point before the point, to understand what these stories might be doing for us or what they're inviting us to think about. If we were engaged by the world by being expelled in a good way from the womb, as a gift of life, then, and that comes on life's terms, meaning bound to a world now of life and death, that process will entail suffering and grief and the problematics of embodiment, which originate in the way desires originate in us. And so we're going to end up with two decidedly different strategies or worldviews. The dominant strategy, held by 99% of everyone who calls themselves or identifies with yoga, is the liberation strategy. Liberation means that when you came into the world bound by its conditions, that world called samsara is a problem to be solved. Samsara is driven by desire, which is unrequitable. There's nothing you can do to satisfy that desire except keep doing the same damn thing over and over again. Like eat breakfast, hungry by lunch, right? And the liberationists come along and they say, this sounds like madness to us because you have to do the same thing over and over again and you don't actually get the result you want, which is a kind of final or complete satisfaction. a liberation from the problem. And the problem is that desire causes unfinishable results, right? Because no matter what you do, you can't finish it. So the first strategies mean to quell that problem, attenuate it, slow it down, then excise you from the problem, and then exempt you from the problem so that liberation in finality means no longer subject to this process of endlessly repeated chronic desire. That's what nirvana means in the Buddhist. It means extinction, and it means extinction from that samsara. So the samsara nirvana, or the bondage liberation model, is 99.9% of yoga. Pause there. Tantra is simply the argument that we know the faster, more efficient, more delicate, more sophisticated, more difficult, but certainly the faster way out. As we have, and the Buddhists give you again the best language for it, because the Buddhist, one of the ways the Buddhists talk about tantra is they call it Vajrayana. Yana meaning to go, or to have a vehicle, or to have a means. It's another verb, to go. Vajra means like a lightning bolt.
No, you said that you're not supposed to look for a way out.
Wait. This is all first model.
Okay.
I said there were two. Okay. This is the liberation model.
Okay. But you just said Tantra.
Tantra says 99% of Tantra is on this model.
Oh, you're not talking about Vijanaka yet.
No.
I'm sorry.
Okay. No. Right. The dominant tradition, it's so dominant that by the time we get to the other model, it doesn't even look like it's on the radar. Okay. Bear with me. Okay? But this model starts out with we've got the race car. Like, we've got the fast way around this track. We have the sure way out. But that's going to require this extraordinary disposition. It's going to require having been born in a karmically superior position. It's going to be born, you're going to have to get the right teacher. You're going to have to get the secret decoder ring from the Cracker Jack box. You're going to have to like get whispered in your ear and the initiation and all this other horseshit that has to do with how you're in some privileged teaching that gives you the privileged way to get the privileged exit. Because the goal is exit. Is everybody clear about that? And that exit will be called bliss, or it'll be called unconditional, or it'll be called all that other stuff that's supposed to be appealing. But it is unconditional. Okay. Sigh. 99% of Hinduism, Buddhism, everything after the Vedic revolution is this model. Except one tiny sliver. Okay? Tim.
Well, if what you said earlier is true, that everything, even unconditional love, has a condition.
Wait. That's our view. Their view, let's clarify, like Buddha love, just to get this squared away. Not to pick on the Buddha, because I kind of like the Buddha's kind of like that. But he is on an exit path. Buddhist compassion is pity for your pathetic state. Okay, your pathetic state is that you're captive of your endless, unrequitable desires, and you keep doing the same stupid thing over and over again. So they're defining ordinary life as insanity. Pause. Before the age of the Buddha, before the rise of this teaching of liberation, in the old Vedic world, and like in the old goddess world of the South, there is no liberation. In fact, doing that same stupid thing over and over again in an incredibly successful way, like loving and grieving again and again and again, is the goal. The vast majority of Hindu and Buddhist teaching is telling you that the old version of the goal is the problem we solve. Now, why did they do that? So in the Vedic world, like in the old Aman world, A-M-M-A-N, that's the Tamil world of the mothers, the goal is literally, and this is the Rajanaka goal, is live long and prosper. Like, that's it. Because, as we said, no matter what unconditionality you claim there to be, it is, in fact, just another conditionality.
So, to be alive is that.
Except you'd have to think two things. So the rise of liberation, the rise of the liberation theory, which you need to understand, is 99% of every text, every tradition, and every story. Like, this is the dominant model. Now, I don't mean dominant, I mean the model, and we are the tiniest exception to the fact. depends on three things. First, it depends on an incredibly successful world. You don't get people wanting to exit the world, renounce the world, give away their goods, cross the river, step out of the village, walk away from home and family, unless you have home and family, right? In other words, you're not renouncing the world when you're a homeless person, right? So the homeless wanderer, that is the extraordinary character who's stepping out, the sadhu on the riverside, right, is predicated on a successful world. And what you're telling yourself, point two, is that the successful world is just a rat race. Like, it's just a hamster wheel. It's just a pie shop. Let me caveat for 30 seconds. When Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, worked in Heidelberg, the women of Heidelberg used to say that they could bake pies by Professor Kant's walk to the office every day, because he walked by at exactly the same time every day. Now, of course, he's German, so we would expect no less, because they're fucking nuts, okay? But like the Italian in the back of the room goes, oh, yeah. You want your Germans making cars, and you want your Italians making food, okay? So
we are good at cars, too.
Yeah, well, you're good at beautiful cars.
Yes.
Yeah, the most beautiful cars are Italian cars. Yes. That's why Porsche makes it, because you look at a Porsche and you go, that looks strangely Italian to me. It's almost as beautiful as a Ferrari. Runs a lot better.
Almost.
So exactly. No, quite so. So the argument is that the old worlds, the mother world of the goddess traditions that are autochthonous, those are the aboriginal worlds of South India, and the Vedic worlds came to India, like merge in India, in a world in which success, live long and prosper, is the only goal. The first predicate of the transformation to the renunciate world, to liberation models, which are going to be mature Buddhism, Jainism, mature Hinduism, right, is first a successful world, as it were, to leave. You have to have a certain disenchantment with the successful world. You have to go, that successful world doesn't look so successful to me because I'm a hamster on a wheel and I'm baking pies and there ain't no way out. And if this is it, I keep after doing the same thing over and over again, right? So it's not insane. The second predicate is that I'm going to leave that successful world and create a radically different alternative lifestyle, because even being near it consigns me to the hamster wheel. That is, there's no way to stay. So now we get right 1,000 years before the Christian era, right up to the edge of the historical, say, the Tirthankaras of Jainism, Mahavira, the historical Buddha. By the time of the historical Buddha, 500 before the Christian era, right? We not only have the disenchantment crowd, we've got to go look for something else that has nothing to do with civilization, nothing to do with worldly success. We're going to go sit by the river, we're going to go to the mountaintop, we're going to go to the cave, we're going to go to the cremation ground, we're going to go to the forest, but we're out of here. And we're going to rigorously, fastidiously, attentively create, as it were, an alternative. That is, we're not going to try to succeed in the world, we're going to try to dissociate from the world. Renunciation, the rise of asceticism. In the legend of the historical Buddha, he's got every posh commitment, right? Remember, the Buddha isn't a homeless guy. The Buddha was a prince. He leaves because princeliness doesn't seem to be working very well for him, because he's disenchanted. And he sees the four sights. That is, he sees old age, disease, death, and a renunciate. Those are the famous four sights of the Bodhisattva prince. He sees old age, disease, death, and the renunciate. And his charioteer says that renunciate is trying to create an alternative to old age, disease, and death, which everyone invariably will experience. He's a young man and doesn't think anything like that will happen until he tries to register his chariot for chariot insurance, and then he figures out that being young, he has very much higher rates because he doesn't think he can die, right? Because he doesn't, sorry.
He didn't call
Geico. Exactly. He had a long talk with a gecko, next thing you know, he's out of there. Okay, so the problem is, though, he's not onto something, and that is that we live the unexamined life in a process in which goals and achievements substitute for meaning. But the second claim is that you'll find no meaning in the ordinary processes of life. You must forsake those. You must go to the forest and stand on one leg and put your left pinky in your right ear and say humput swaha until your vrikshasana is atrophied in like unperturbed deflection of all problems. Now you can go fast forward, because one of the things the tantricas are going to do is they're going to turn that renunciate character into sort of Casino Royale James Bond. That is, because you'll remember in the replay of that, right? Bond gets captured and tortured by the villains, and his basic strategy is that if I don't mind, it don't matter. Get it? So they're going to admit that the world is torture, but you could stay in the world, but if you don't give any fucks, that would be the technical term, then it doesn't, then your renunciation can still be in the world, but you are unaffected by the world. Because in fact, you want nothing from the world. So the Bond torture argument is, there's nothing you could do to me to get this information, because I don't care what you do to me. Like, I don't care what the world brings. I am immune, invulnerable, unperturbed, and indifferent to what the world does. Now, Tantra is going to take that view of asceticism, which means it's going to let the swamis, the word swami, does everyone know what the word swami means? It means self-possessed. Swami, it means saying only me. Swa is the reflexive pronoun in Sanskrit. It means oneself. And ami is the verb to be. So swami means autonomous. It means isolate. It means only. It means only I. What you're really saying is, I don't need for nothing. Like, I don't need anything that the world has to offer. I am independent. And you'll see that this kind of language follows up in these deeply ascetical traditions that have to do world problem, this thing you're doing, stop doing that, this cycle of death and re-death, of death and rebirth, samsara, you want to stop that. And then you get things like Patanjali Yoga, which is a horrible book, by the way. When you really study it, it's just a travesty of decency.
Just finishing a training.
No, I can help you with it. I can help you with it, but I want you to learn it the same way I want you to learn Newtonian physics. Like, it once seemed like a good idea.
Yeah.
It's just bullshit. It's just not true, okay? Like, it's a bad idea, and it has almost no redeeming features. So I can explain to you why I think that. But its basic premise is that its goal, like, think of what its goals are. It has three goals. Nirodha, which means that thing you're doing, stop that. Like, that thing, don't do that. It means stop. It means occlude. It means prevent, right? Yogacitta vritti nirodha. It means put up a barrier and don't do that, right? And what it doesn't want you to do is move, change, or think.
Yeah.
It doesn't want you to do anything. It just wants you, because that's what the world does, because as soon as you think, you'll think something else, which means as soon as you want, you'll want something else, and it wants you to stop doing that. Point one. Point two, it wants you to bring your consciousness to samadhi, to the place where your dehi, your awareness, is only one thing. What are you going to do?
Gunas.
We're not going to.
What?
What about the other gunas?
No, samadhi's not a guna. No, the gunas are there.
No, I'm saying if you're on one thing.
Yeah, where's everything else? Well, yeah, gunas are all there to tell you to stop doing that. It's all about extrication, excisation. It's all about stop that. Or focus on one thing so none of those other things matter. Because that's what samadhi means. It means this thing, not that thing. You're going to have trouble navigating traffic lights and traffic that way. Okay? Because it doesn't really... And we get all weird about this. Like, no multitasking, can't do more than one thing at a time. What are you, some kind of idiot? You're doing millions of things at the same time all the time? All the time. But it doesn't want you to be in this body in the way you are, because all of that is driven by desire and ephemera and unfinished business, which definitely it is, right? So the second strategy is think only of one thing, right? That is, don't let the mind move, because after you cut everything out, stop moving. And then it calls its goal kaivalya, right? So kaivalya is a word in Sanskrit that comes from the word kevala, which means only. And kaivalya means the state of only that. Furthermore, it's built on a metaphysic in which everything that changes is not you, and the only thing that doesn't change is you. So everything that's not you is called prakriti, the material world, and everything that is you is simply called purusha, and it never does anything, it never changes, it never evolves, it can't. It is by definition only itself. Really? You really want nothing to do with your body, your appetites, your change, your materiality. You really are that indifferent to it because there's this permanent thing in you that you somehow imaginarily think is you. I'm positing a small critique. And then the whole rest of the book, you have to get through the first seven sutras to understand the book. And the first one goes, are you ready for this? Like Atta Yoga Anushasana. Are you ready for this? Because if you're ready for this, I'll tell you. And then he tells you really pretty much in a very straightforward, standard Indian scholarly argument. He says, he defines the problem as he sees it. And then he says, if you're on to this, and you know that there's this one thing that doesn't change, and you don't have any relationship to the rest of the, if you don't need to stop anything, you're focused on one thing, and this is the only thing that you experience, you don't need to read the rest of the book. He literally says that, because the verse that starts ituratre means otherwise, meaning if you're fucked up because you don't get these things, read the rest of the book. Here's the manual to how to do these three things. How to create the Nirodha, how to arrive in the state of samadhi, and how to be only that, in which case you wouldn't care what the world is doing to you. Furthermore, keep reading, there's no reentry strategy. He's not telling you, like, if we finish this by Sunday, we can go out for wings and beer. Like, he is not doing that. There is no second piece of this. The only second piece of this is that if you failed at this, you'll just have to keep doing this until you finally get out. That's the entire book. Now, I'm not making...
Isn't there a samadhi that includes the world?
No. Absolutely not. Now, the tantricas want a samadhi that includes the world, okay. but now they want Teflon. They want love, but no grief. Okay. They want to be in the world, but I'm not bothered by it. They want to wear the Tom Ford suit and the way cool sunglasses, the Verno sunglasses, which I like a lot, by the way, right? Because they are very beautiful. They want to drive that Aston Martin because it's an English thing and you can't really drive the Ferrari, but it would be better if you had the Ferrari. But you also are going to get tortured, but you don't give a fuck. So you want all the benefit and none of the grief. Basic tantra of the liberation model is exactly that. We can walk through the world unblemished by the world with all of its advantages and none of its disadvantages. That's Abhinavagupta, that's Kshemaraja, that's Kashmir Shaivism, soup to nuts. That's a con job. that was a little bit of editorial opinion. Randall.
The idea of a Swami, just thinking when you were talking in the first session about this kind of almost fatal flaw in the American psyche, the male psyche, of the self-made man.
So yes.
It's very much like that.
Yes.
Thinking that you can make yourself, you can rise up by your own means.
And the next thing you know, you're as fucked up as John Wayne and Ronald Reagan. Because you're going to say to yourself, no apologies, no excuses, no explanations. I can't be wrong. Yeah. It's the slippery slope to narcissism is right in front of your face.
It's right? Like the only method they have, the only strategy they have is to just build a bigger wall.
Exactly.
Or the shield.
Exactly. The more insulation, more impermeability.
More, yeah.
Right? More Nirodha.
More Nirodha, build a bigger wall, and it just leads to compounding.
Impenetrability. And that kind of self-satisfying narcissism, which is really a nihilism for the rest of the world. Because then when other people fail, you go, well, it's their fault. Because I'm me. Doesn't sound like a me problem, is the obnoxious answer. Right? Let's make one more caveat on this. Because in the liberation models, you need to understand another feature. What's the difference between the bhaktas, who practice bhakti? Bhakti is devotion. Bhakta is someone who practices bhakti. So bhakta is the noun and bhakti is the title. The difference between bhakti and tantra is very simple in a liberation model. In bhakti, all tantrikas are bhaktas, but not all bhaktas are tantrikas. Okay, and this is why. In bhakti, you can't finish this project of extrication without extrinsic help. You need God, you need grace. Something else has to do it for you. That is that last bit of Nirodha, Kaivalya, Samadhi has to be conferred. The tantrikas go, you become the god. Effectively, the bhaktas are dualists of a kind of grace orientation of theism. That it's God's got to do this last little trick of liberation. You can bring yourself with all your efforts and all your sadhanas right up to the edge, and then God kind of pulls you. Which is why the Hare Krishnas, who are Gaudiya Vaishnavas, wear the top knot. They wear the top knot because Krishna's going to take the last little bit and pull them to heaven. Because you can't liberate yourself. The basic distinction. In bhakti traditions, you don't liberate yourself. Something, someone, some other kind of thing does the liberation. Now, the reason all tantrikas are bhaktas in the liberation model is because they have to have the secret decoder ring whisper in your ear guru, right, who teaches you how to do it. So the guru doesn't liberate you, but without the guru, you can't be liberated. Get it? So you're still stuck in you need the secret decoder ring to get the fast way out, because that's what they're teaching. They're teaching everybody else is going to fail because it's a long and winding road and you're not going to make it. You get the tantra, you get the way out. That's what the liberation traditions teach. Now, are we ready to blow all of that away? Randy.
So you said kevalya means...
Onlyness.
Onlyness, so it's...
Isolation
like
is...
to me, separation.
It is.
So it's not union. So at the end, they're talking about yoga or union, but at the end...
As separation from the world of samsara. That is, you no longer identify yourself with the changing, desirous ephemera of your mortal, conditioned, limited birth.
So isn't that contradictory?
Bear with me. Exactly right. You're unlimited. You're now unlimited, not limited. You're not mortal because you have identified with the immortal and cast off the mortal. Right? You're no longer conditioned. You are unconditioned. So all the conditions that ordinarily apply no longer apply to you. That is straight up Patanjali yoga. I'm not, no axes to grind, no bad feelings, just telling you what the stuff says. The Tantrika's version of that is that you don't have to renounce the world to do that. You can just Teflon your way through the world. But you do need to have the secret decoder ring to get the fast way out. You need the special teachings, you need the guru, you need the mantras, and you're not going to get that unless you're ready for it and gurus decide that. Okay. So
no,
I said...
the Tantrikas say that the way is to be yourself.
Sure, but yourself immune from the world.
No.
Yes. Oh, yes. Exactly what Abhinavagupta says. He says, when you are saturated in the state of pure consciousness, that the ephemera experience of consciousness, the conditionality of consciousness, no longer affects you. It no longer moves you. It no longer changes you. You're like, I'm okay with it. You're just okay with it because you're in this supernal state of exemption. You're one.
You're making it way too broad. I studied with Christopher Wallace, and I know he was a student of yours.
Was.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No, I understand what they're saying.
He's saying that it's all included. He says tantra is to fall in love with the whole of life.
And especially in a way in which when all the grief arrives, you are not really subject to it. The most important part of yourself is unconditional. You can't get unconditional and say love is grief. There is no tradition of liberation that says grief is a good thing. Not one. Not one. They can't do it. They can say you're going to grieve, but really your true self never grieves. Your true self is ecstatic. Your true self is pure. Your true self is a consciousness immune from all those changes. So you have a true self, and then you have this other kind of self that you learn to incorporate, you talk about integrating it. But basically, your unconditional self is unconditional. That is, it isn't subject to any terms. Now, that's because these are all liberation models. Throw out the liberation model. Just throw it out. And start here, just as a different... I'm telling you to not believe this or don't believe that. My first claim about the liberation models is, if you like that, good luck. See how that feels being unconditioned. Because you can claim, but I would also suggest, and this would be a rather interesting conditional claim, that if you arrive at this place where you go, you know what, but really he's in a better place. Really, unconditional love conquers all. Like, unconditional love is untainted by grief. And I would say to you, does that make you feel good? Because that's about all it does.
Nobody's saying unconditional love is untainted by grief. There's an idea of being...
No, absolutely not. Abhinavagupta, Kshemaraja, this is nonsense. They say that the unconditional self,
well, the tantra
pure
that
consciousness,
I'm studying now and that I believe in is including all the grief and everything.
Well, good luck for them, because if he's claiming this comes from the texts don't say that. The texts say you arrive at a state in which the integration and the inclusion of conditionality leaves you immune to its problematic. You are no longer in the problematic. And I'm suggesting that you're not only in the problematic, you don't really want to leave it.
You want to get smart at navigating it, right?
you want not only navigating it, you want to be in it.
And enjoy it.
Well, you'll enjoy some of it and you'll be miserable by some of it, but so is life.
Okay. Well, that's a tantra that I believe we talk about here at the studio.
Sure. Well, I don't have a belief pattern here. I'm trying to describe alternative views.
Okay.
So, I think there's creative license happening sometimes.
Oh, you think? The people who are sort of advocating an old view of the tantra these days that I know about are claiming it's all connected to those texts, and I say, well, it would be if it were more honest about what liberation is. And liberation is, first of all, not likely, because that's the basic premise, is that most of Abhinavagupta says at the beginning of the Tantra Loka that because I was born, my parents conceived me in a tantric ritual, I am liberated and you never will be. Like, that's what the text says. You can make it say what you want, but that's what it says. And then he's also going to say, and when you arrive at the state of pure consciousness and absolute bliss, and use all the capital letters, the divine, these are all just capital offenses, as far as I'm concerned. Like all the capital letters, the divine consciousness, DC. What you're really saying is you're in some kind of special condition. And you are. That's the claim. And I'm claiming there is no such thing as any special condition. It's a dehumanizing claim. It's dehumanizing. Because to be human is to be in no special condition. It's to be in the same goddamn position we're all in. Right? That being my point. That's my fundamental objection with it. Is that there are no siddhas who are perfect. There are no beings exempt. Nobody gets a privilege. Nobody gets an exit. Nobody gets a special deal. Everybody's got the same deal. From soup to nuts, everybody's got the same deal. We're all going to die more or less in grief. And more and less in love, because we're human. We all get exact. See, that's my problem with the way Tantra is really taught, is that it's claiming that there's this kind of better state you can be in. No, there's just a human state you can be in. That's kind of where we're coming from. But let's go back, because before Tantra and before the ascetical yoga, there are three points. You had to have a world that you didn't like. You have to have the disenchantment principle. Success breeds disenchantment. You have to have this alternative model. We're going to go renounce the world. And the tantra goes, you don't need to do that. You can just stay in the world and you'll get all the benefits, right? But you'll still, but because three is the third point, and that is there is a superior state. And they call that superior state union or supreme consciousness. And you achieve that. So there are people who have it and people who don't. Pause right there. I fundamentally object to that claim.
Me too.
Okay, but that's their claim, and there's no way around it. There is zero way around that claim. Like, you can go, it's all integrated in the world, and this and that, but you're still saying, in some sense, these people have something that you don't have until you have it. And my own teacher thought that that was fundamentally dehumanizing, like in an inexcusable claim, because sooner or later, we're all going the same way. And we all have the same problems. And that's what the graciousness of these myths show us. Because we're going to arrive at this generation. Let's make sure we make one Ganesha comment before we don't, right? And that is the key to the Ganesha myth, is that he's the beginning of a second generation, where the fundamental issue is that he's a mess because his parents are a mess. Right? And that is the genius of the mythology. Because that puts us squarely in his generation. Get it? All of us are the casualties of the goodness and the badness of our parents, their hopes and aspirations, their successes and failures, because all of us had that very strange critical moment somewhere in our teens where we went, oh my parents are human, right? Because when you were little, your parents were the gods.
Parents are not human.
No, but they have the same problem all of us have, which is neither of them think they can be wrong, right? Like the Shiva and Shakti myths are Shiva and Shakti kind of acting out their own self-superiorities in their strange intimate relationship, in which, in a certain way, neither of them thinks that either of them has done anything wrong. Like the beginning of the Ganesha story is that she's lonely, she creates this thing. But again, she does it without conversation, without consent, without communication. And she thinks that's okay? Remember how we told the story earlier. So my claim is that they're, but they mean to be good parents, don't mistake me. They are the gods, that's pretty great, right? But they're screwed up too. Has everybody got that? Like, you have to start there. You have to start that we're all in exactly the same mess and none of us ever get out of it, which is the opposite of liberation. Okay? Now, I read the myths that way. But here's the really interesting point. Again, before the liberation model, the goddess models of the sun and the Vedic model had no concept of liberation. It was live long and prosper. Now, here's a key to where this model really actually continues, because it's the hungry god. When you go to see Nataraja, where Nataraja dances, you don't get any intimations of liberation by any of these symbolic methods. What do you get? So next to the Nataraja image inside the temple, there are two boxes, and one of them has a crystalline linga, piece of glass about this big, and the other has a ruby Nataraja about this big. This crystalline linga comes out 6 times in the day, right? They take it out of the inner sanctum, and the priest of the day is going to attend to this. And what he's going to do is he's going to spend the better part of an hour and 15 minutes, 6 times a day, and he's going to pour water and coconut milk and flowers and dust and fruit and ghee and honey and sandalwood and piles of rice again and again and again and again. That doesn't sound like liberation to me. It sounds like a god who's so hungry he has to eat 6 times in a day. Sating in a voluminous meal. It sounds like, and so if the model is liberation, that model is come. That model, that's my mother's model. You'd stop at my mother's house, like I had to go to like an event. I go, I just came from a dinner. Oh, it was so much. I just wanted to stop and see you. She goes, so you wait. I go, yes. She goes, sit down, I'll make you something. My Italian mother. That's the model. It's not liberation. It's more hunger. It's more hunger. The goal of life isn't to be freed from desire. It's to get hungrier. It's to want more conditions, not fewer. You're trying to deepen the relationship. You're trying to fall. If you really want to fall in love with the world and fall in love with everybody, you have just bought more grief in every possible direction. That's a model I can get on board with, because you're wanting more desire. You're not quenching or solving desire so that your desires are somehow divine and absolutely fulfilled. Okay. If that's the model, I would say, that doesn't strike me as liberation. It strikes me as a con job about consolation. You just want to feel better. Like, you just want to think that there's this thing that will save you. As soon as you give up on being saved from anything, you can get on with living. And one of the appeals of the liberation model is it sounds a lot like salvation, which might sound a little familiar to us. Does that make sense? Like, maybe we're buying that because we had already bought it. We're just retranslating it to, oh, and now everyone is God. Or now it's all God.
So how do we know Rajanika's not a con job?
Because I don't, well, it's conning you into the idea that that if you want some meaning, you're going to have to make it. But it's the con job is there's no end game. Our con job is that the sadhana, the practice, is going to give us all the sort of symbols and content of being hungry, of wanting more. What you want that's more is not my business. I'm not conning you into anything. There's no end game. Furthermore, the argument is that the content, like in this case, the stories or the myths or the rituals, right, are content. But Rajanika is a simple argument. It's 3 things. Let me make it clear for you. It's ask any question, especially the ones that are hard to ask, aren't asked, don't have questions, or might upset you. So we're getting rid of all incontrovertible authority. Ain't nobody the boss. And the more difficult the question you ask, whether it's unwanted or destabilizing or controversial, or maybe you're not, don't ask just the questions you can answer or are allowed to ask. Ask any question.
Do you see yourself as the boss of Regina?
Not at all. Okay. I just want you to ask better questions. In the undergraduate classroom, those are the rules, and they have to ask better questions. What they learn is that I'm better at it than they are. But you wouldn't. But you're here because I'm better at it than you are.
I know.
Right? So, but we're. I'm not. But virtuosity doesn't make me different. Does that make sense? Because everyone in the room, and this is really important, can do something I can't do a million times better than I do this. You know why? I have a limited skill set, and it's mostly this. Get it? So we're moving around authority rather than claiming a special state. There is no special state. You become, yoga is virtuosity and becoming yourself. That's what Sundaramurti always said, right? So the first strategy of Rajanika is that you only become better at being yourself when you're willing to break in, break down, break through, get your head ripped off, lose the dice game, find the extra missing and broken piece. That is, keep asking. This is a good story, and Randall knows this. You know this story well. In the early 80s, I was in Buddhist studies at Harvard. I started in Buddhist studies because that's where the smart philosophers were. And so I got a lot of FaceTime with the Dalai Lama, and then I wrote a bunch of articles for him, ghost wrote, because that's what usually happened. And every time I did that, which was really swell, I would get like 15 minutes with him. It was really sweet, like you got your one-on-one. I always asked him the same question. And by the third time, he said, you know, every time you come here, you ask me the same question. And I said, and the question was, do you really think you're the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet? This is like walking up to the Pope on Easter and going, this resurrection thing, you got to be kidding me. Right? And he said, why do you ask this question? And I said, because it's the question that other people don't think they can ask. It's the uncomfortable question.
What did he say?
He said, of course he is. He's the 14th. He's the Dalai Lama. He's not supposed to think he's the 14th. Yeah, exactly. See my hat? Exactly. It's like asking the Pope around resurrection. Like, I was like, of course he's going to say he rose from the dead. He's the fucking Pope. Right? So, and then the follow-up question was, are you answering in that way? Because you have to. Right? Or do you really, or like, what would it mean? Like, do you ever question that? And then he said yes, and then I had a lot more. Then the respect ticks in. Because the second piece of it is, there's three pieces I said. It's ask any question, especially the ones that break in. The problem with modern STEM education, this is an important point, is that science is mostly answering questions it has already asked. So you can get all the way through a serious like BS in chemistry and learn not one new thing. Because it's all been figured out. And they're really good at it. So it really has been figured out. Right? But they don't ask questions for that they don't have answers for. And in the humanities, you're always trying to ask questions that you don't have answers for. And then, but then you've got to like rip it apart. It's one of the ironies. You want students to feel safe, but safety is the problem. Like, I'm not here to make you feel safe. I'm here to make you feel uncomfortable, right? To be subverted. Now, you need to be safe enough to be subverted. You see how the paradox works? But that's the strategy. That's why it's not a con game, because I want you to feel safe, but I'm going to make you feel really uncomfortable.
Because that is
Rajanika love.
Okay.
Like, in other words, it was like saying I got yelled at.
Yeah.
It's just a sweetness, because you have to be funny about that, but what you really are saying is when you stop subverting the very paradigm you're in, you stop learning. Because belief inhibits learning, because you go, I know that. Mm-hmm. Being comfortable with doubt, uncertainty, subversion is a very difficult thing to do. And the older we get, the harder it is, because we're wired to want to believe and we're wired to certainties. Right? The point of Ganesha, let's just go there for a second, isn't to get over obstacles or withstand obstacles or even to create obstacles. It's to sit in the uncertainty. It's to be comfortable. It's to figure out how to stay pliant and supple and serious enough that your discomforts are kind of the thing you need.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much soothing and satisfying. The soothing and satisfying part is kind of deep irony. You're soothed and satisfied precisely because no amount of soothing or satisfying story, like there's a state of liberation, is ever going to work for you. Point did. That was all one. Was ask every question. The second one is follow the evidence wherever it takes you. Be prepared to change your mind and don't expect to be applauded for it. Right? This is why it's not the 11th century anymore. So, for example, if we have really good, you guys know more about the physiology of the body, and modern asana has seriously pushed the paradigm of yoga forward. Why? Indians aren't doing that. They didn't do that in the 11th century. You know way more. At which point, it's not the 11th century anymore. So why look back for the 11th century for the truths of the world? Like, Abhinava was a guy who wrapped his dhoti like a gym towel like everybody else. And I am not going to privilege what anybody says because knowledge is supposed to progress. And by the way, it has. Right? We don't, you know, like, sooner or later, they're going to figure out the coronavirus genome. Right? That's serious business. Your cell phone goes through the wall. These people didn't know that the world, you know, the earth went around the sun or how babies were born. Who are we kidding? Right? So I got no nostalgia. I have respect, because in the 11th century they were pretty clever. But move forward. Like, follow the evidence. We need a yoga for the 21st century. And that includes everything we know now. Third point. Don't be too sure of yourself. Black swan. Every time you arrive at, I got it, go, maybe, sure, keep looking. We needn't be too insecure by our own subversion. And learning to be secure in your insecurity. Like, something more at these best moments when we talk together, is I'd ask him something and he'd go, you know, I don't know. And then he would either say one of two things. He would say, you should ask somebody else. So I arrived, I got this job, I had left in 86. I came back in the summer of 86 because I got a job in the 3 weeks I was home, the job I have now. And I went back, fleeing back to India, terrified. Like, Appa, what am I going to do? Like, I have a job, I have an insurance plan, I have a retirement program. I have no idea what to do with this. Can you help me? He looked at me, he goes, you need a financial advisor. Because he didn't think he knew the answers to those questions. But he did know enough to say he didn't know, and he did know enough to say, I think somebody else does know. That also mitigates the con job a little bit. Because you're not the great and almighty Oz.
Tell them that what you told me before we started this afternoon.
Oh.
You were talking with him.
Yeah, so the meme that went up last week was, it was when I was liberated from liberation, but I was finally free to be human. When I was liberated from liberation, I was finally free to be human. Now, I went to India looking for the guru, for the tantra, who would liberate me, with the guy with all the answers, who would do that. I came to this guy, asked him for that, and you know, and he said, okay, I can teach you about that. Because he could. He knows exactly what the story is. And then, but on the opposite side of that page, because these are in my diaries, he was talking about making a trip to the temple from our town, which has to do with making train reservations. And then he says two things within a minute. He says, you know, he would always start with that. He goes, you know, we don't have a plan, but we know what we're doing. And then 2 minutes later, he says, you know, we have a plan, but we don't know what we're doing. And I just wrote both down. And on the bottom, I went, that makes perfect sense to me. But the idea was, you know, like, if you don't have a plan B, you don't have a plan. Because Indians are like that. On the other hand, nothing works in India. So you have to always go, okay, like, whatever's next. But tell some more Ganesha stories. Because the idea here is we can either tell these stories. Here was my point. You can tell these stories as liberation stories, or you can tell, and as bhakti stories, so he's going to save you, or you're going to save yourself, or you can tell these stories without salvation of any kind. At which point, the stories are, so what does the tantra do if it doesn't get you faster to liberation, which was Mo's question? before. And the short answer is, it doesn't make the world, doesn't get you faster to liberation, it gets you deeper into the problems, into the issues. It just wants you to, it wants us to be able to go to the unconscious and come back a little more astute than the last time, a little more savoring the experience of our humanity, which doesn't elevate us. You know, Appa did this wonderful thing. It's an old Indian trope, but he used to like to do it. He would look at you. Tell me your name again, please.
Laura.
He would look at you. I'll do it to you because you don't know me. Okay. He would look at you and he'd go, if you make a mistake, don't make it again. If you make it again, make it again. So, because the strategy was that you have to take seriously the criticism. And the other side of it is, if you're beating yourself up, you're not taking the criticism seriously. Get it? Because beating yourself up doesn't help you take the criticism seriously. So you got to be able to take the hit, but realize that the hit, in a certain way, is just another human thing. Because every time you say to yourself, I'm not going to make that mistake again, there's nobody in this room young enough to think that you will. You all will, right? So instead of going, I'm going to get this right, you go, isn't it interesting? Like with your Marvin Martian voice on, like, isn't it interesting that, wait a second, I made that same stupid mistake again. What the hell is wrong with me? And the answer is, the same thing that's wrong with everybody else, relax. Like, but don't get complacent. In other words, it is acceptance. But it's acceptance because the point is, no one of us is special. It's the end. One way or another, we're either all snowflakes, so everybody's an individual, which is trivial, or one of us is a better snowflake than the rest of us. That's a liberation model, by definition. You can't have it any other way. So I just want to get rid of all of that and go back to like the original. So when Sundaramurti talked about Rajanika as being a Vaidika tantra, that is a Vedic tantra, he wasn't talking about moral purity or Brahmins. He was saying, no, our goal isn't faster liberation. It's learning to live long and prosper in this much more complicated way. That is where we're taking seriously the fact that this life isn't a problem to be solved. It's a series of strange paradoxes that we have to embrace. The first and the most important paradox is that to love is to grieve. So when you sign up for one, you've gotten the other. And you literally know light from shadow. And liberation models go, there are no shadows, there's only light. The goal is light. And I would say, the more brightly you burn, the more shadow you cast.
Which is a troubling thing, because I can't end my emails lately, because I don't know how to, like, say, for example, well, have a nice day, or everyone's like, Happy New Year. Now I'm like, well, have the year you're going to have.
Because you are, because you don't know what's coming.
Or,
yeah.
I don't know how to. Social
you
just don't know what to say anymore.
But it's
weird.
Well,
you got it. Yeah, I love isn't the answer. Yeah. Love is the risk.
Yeah.
Love isn't an answer. It's the risk you take, right? And so what you're trying to do, like, what's an interesting Rajanika path? Fewer chances, more risks. It's not a bad thing to take a chance, because chances aren't necessarily a bad thing. My retirement program hinges on it. Like, I drive by that big billboard with the lotto sign on it on the way to work, and I'm always really angry because when the number goes back to 40, it means somebody won.
Yeah.
And you're like, son of a bitch, why wasn't it me? You know, like envy, greed, all those good emotions come flooding in, right? But here's another trick. Like in liberation models, you get liberation in bondage. So you're also going to get what you get in potentially. You're going to get like happiness good, grief bad. Or you're going to get joy good, anger bad. You're even going to get courage good, fear bad. That's insane. Okay? Because if you're not a little afraid walking out in the traffic in Florida, you are not courageous. You're just crazy. Okay? So a tincture of fear is a fine thing. Okay? You wouldn't have it if you didn't need it. And this kind of excision, expurgating, fixing yourself isn't really right. Like, it's going to make you crazy because you're never going to get it right. So let's keep going. So let's tell more Ganesha. So we know that we have an upside-down elephant who's both the top and the bottom of the world. We know that the elephant's legs are four pillars. They act like pillars. So part of what the myth is telling you is that there is no beyond and there is no infinite. It's just really big. Like the first principle of it being pachydermian, elephantine, is that it doesn't have to be infinite, it doesn't have to be eternal, it doesn't have to be capital anything, absolute or divine. It's just really frickin' huge. And so you're not, it's the same physics problem we have with like other planets. The problem isn't whether there's life on other planets, the problem is they're really far away. Like really, really, really far away. Like fucking far away. Like, and there's no real physics solution to it, right? In other words, the universe is vast, not infinite. It doesn't have to be infinite. It just has to be so big that it's big enough, bigger than you by a long shot. And so you don't need to fantasize infinite or eternal. All you need to go is, there are really big things in the world. Know where you are in perspective with that. Okay, that's the first thing. But then the myths want to turn this elephant upside down. Because the pillars of the myth, so the elephant is the bottom and at the top. Now, old in the Veda is what's called the Brahma Anda, the egg of the self-expanding egg, the egg of Brahma. Brahma's the creator, and it comes from the verbal root, takes you to that same idea. The Brahman is the Upanishadic word for the everythingness, but it comes from a verbal root that means to expand. And this is what's really cool. Even the Upanishad, which has a lot of bad advice in it, but some interesting ideas, it's going to tell you that the universe grows like the way a balloon does. Like, it doesn't grow into anything, it self-grows. Does that make sense? Brian Greene gave us that example back in one of those physics books. Like, if the universe is expanding, the question is, expanding into what? Like, is there something that it's expanding into? Like, what else could it be if it's itself? And the answer is, no, it expands like a balloon. Like, it is itself just growing itself. That's exactly how the ancient Indian world understands the world. And so it doesn't have, so it isn't an infinite world. It's got a vault, and it's got a bottom. And then, of course, mythologically, the bottom is the top to the demons, and the top is the bottom to the gods. And, interestingly enough, the thing is cracked. So it's an egg with a crack in it. And that's going to have other implications in the story for us. This is a standard motif of the mythology that's way before the Ganesha story. So every time you see cracks, openings, twisted, slithering things, you're seeing trunks, snakes, cracked eggs, extra pieces in the hand. You're seeing the same symbology over and over again. You're seeing that the system, it breaks itself somehow. Now, the reason it breaks itself is that not only because it could continue to expand if it didn't break itself, but it wouldn't change. And here, once again, natural selection really helps us. So how did we get from bacteria to eukaryotic cells to evolution? And the answer is that the process of repeating itself, right, which is incredibly reliable in some portions of the DNA strand, that there's pieces of us that haven't changed in 2.8 billion years, right? That's astonishing degree of successful recursion. But then actually what happens is, for no reason at all, that's the word mutation, for no purpose, for no goal, for no reason, that's lila, right? That's the word we're going to use here in the yoga. For no reason at all, the system doesn't repeat itself perfectly. It actually changes, because the opposite is it stays the same. If it doesn't change, it can't grow. Because otherwise, it would just repeat itself infinitely. It would stay the same. It doesn't stay the same, because that's not your experience. So now, go back to Yoga 101. Go with your experience. The world changes. The world changes because it fails to keep up with the process of recursion. It fails the process of recursion itself. So, the myths want to turn our heads around in this way. We ordinarily experience time as waking ordinary human beings in one predominant way. That is, as the arrow of time, as past, present, and future, as linear time, right? And from that, we gain a lot of interesting insights, particularly no take-backs, no do-overs, right? So you did that, like you broke the glass, or you spill the tea, getting the tea back in is really hard. Why? Because the reason why is really important. It's because if you spill the tea, the molecules by entropy are too scattered, and getting that much information back into order is too hard. But the irony of it is that once you spill it, where it is, now, so it's more ordered in the flask. Has everybody got that? When we spill it, that's the next more ordered state. It's less ordered than in the flask, but the only thing that's going to happen next is it's going to become more disorderly from being spilled, right? Because time and entropy, right? So this is all arrow of time. This is all important ways to think inside the myths. In other words, we have to honor the arrow of time because the world is a complex place and putting it back together is a Humpty Dumpty. Okay? It's literally the egg falls off the ledge. Symbolically, you can never miss it. It's all about eggs and cracks and twisted, broken things, right? And you can't really put them back together. However, you can take broken things. The Japanese really get this right. And this is where the Indians really get it right. And this is what Ganesha really is. Ganesha is a kintsugi. Kintsugi is the Japanese tradition of broken pottery that then takes the pot back together and puts a golden line on it and puts it on the shelf and goes, you don't really want to use that for tea anymore, but isn't it beautiful because it was broken? Right? So it's taking broken things and turning them into art, which is what lost loves are. Like if you have exes, you can turn them into kintsugi. You can just go, well, it's broken. I don't really want that back. I'm not really drinking from that again. Right? But you can also say, you know, that's just because without that brokenness, you wouldn't be who you are now. You don't just learn from your mistakes. We accumulate our failures. And until we do, we can't grow. Because you're going to live with them anyway. So you have to figure out how to turn them into kind of golden pottery. That's what the elephant head is. It's we can't get this kid back together. Because one of the questions of the origins myth is why don't we get the elephant's head, why don't we get the baby's head back on? Answer, first kind of time. No take backs, no do-overs. This kid's broken, right? And we can't get it back. We could put it back together with a golden line. Get it? So we can give him another kind of head because it becomes another kind of thing because it's not that thing it was. However, it's always still broken. So accumulate, and what really intimacy ends up being, especially since most of us have failed more than once, is your broken pieces and my broken pieces make for an interesting piece. That's nice. Instead of I fulfill you. Like we get our broken pieces to fit together and make some golden lines, we're probably going to be okay. When you can't make the golden lines between broken pieces, intimacies fall apart. But it isn't like I have the thing you need. That's a misconstrual of the value-added project. Like you always want to be in an intimacy where there's not too much eHarmony, because then you're just dating yourself. You see what I mean by that? Like this person is too much like you. Yeah. That kind of sucks. And you'll get bored because you're smart and intelligent people. You're going to hate that. Like too much compatibility is really weird, okay? So, because it's going to tear you apart eventually. Because your other half is really kind of giving you the thing you don't have. That's not the value-added project. Your other half is giving you something you don't have, and it often annoys you. because what you're really saying is, this person does something the way I don't do it, and I'm supposed to like that? Right? Because they're actually not you. They're actually doing something that isn't you. So you want that until you get it, and then you have it, and you're not sure you like it. And that is a successful value-added project. Get it? Because if you think that other half finishes you off, you're really fucked up. That's going to go really badly. Okay, so broken pieces meet broken pieces. That's the lesson of linear time. The second kind of time, because we have four pillars. The upside-down elephant gives us four pillars. This is called quadratic time, the four pillars of time. It's all elephantine, so it's a Ganesha story. Right. The second kind of, did you like that? Okay. The second kind of time, Randall laughs at my jokes, which really satisfies both my insecure ego and gives me some bro confidence to carry on. because it makes me, I'm not a complete idiot. He's still laughing at my joke. So, which is what my gunnas are all rattling around in my head. Like, did I, you know, like is Cheryl worried if I'm ever going to talk about Ganesha? Is Mo freaking out because I'm undermining everything that she believes? Is Randall still laughing at my jokes? Is Kimberly kind of just okay with me? I love y'all, but I am wondering what you're thinking, okay? So, second kind of time is Ram Dass time. We've renamed it because he wrote the book Be Here Now. So it's Be Here Now. The Buddhists really love this. We call it, in Rajanika, we call it punctiliar time, as in it punctuates time. And it means only now. No past, no future, only the present. The Buddhists really like this one. And then they're going to question the present being anything but another kind of invention of the point. But there's a really cool idea here that delves once again into language and, as usual in the Indian case, into grammar. There's a form of the past, like we have. So the imperfect past means the thing that was done, we don't know if it's finished or not. The perfect means it's finished and it's over. But we have this strange form in Sanskrit that it's also in Greek, but it's never really used. It's called the aorist. And it means it happened once upon a time in the past. But it means to point to an instance. Now, instantaneous time is kind of trivial if you think you only live in the present. Because you can't have a yoga only in the present. Because yoga, a world of yoga is a world of promise. And that is, the world has already made promises and it keeps some and it breaks some. You live in the present, which you're keeping a promise. Because why would you ask yourself this? Why would you make a promise in the present if it didn't have a past? That's like undying love on the first date. It's probably a bad idea, right? Because it doesn't have enough past. But why would you make a promise if it didn't have a future, right? If you didn't have promise. Like, we use the word promise to mean the future. So, in fact, the wisdom of the present is more like tipping point or consequence. That is, something noteworthy happens. It isn't that only the present exists. If you want only the present to exist, you're going to end up in a kind of Vedantin singularity theory. You're going to end up with there's only one reality, and everything that's past doesn't matter, and everything that's future doesn't matter, at which point you really can renounce the world because you really don't have an investment in the future. There's no investment in the future if it's all one, is one, and always has been one, because there's no future. The future is exactly the same as the past, which is exactly the same as the present. So now you're saying it's all the present. I'm telling you that's not only untrue, it's untenable. Furthermore, you don't really care about the world. Now, if you want to be like that, happy cave. See what I'm getting at? Like, again, a good Rajanika con is that we're all telling ourselves a con. I just like mine better. Because I'm happy to point out the foible of yours. So the be here now one is like be in the present, which is kind of be attentive or understand the tipping point or a consequence, but it doesn't mean that only the present exists. It means that events matter. And remembering that events matter is all kinds of ways of not forgetting. And of putting that to lessons to use, especially if the events that mattered were mistakes. Because it's a lot easier to be forgiven than it is to learn from our mistakes. Forgiveness is the other guy's religion. The third kind of time is goes around, comes around. That's the famous Hindu cyclical time. Right? So where I live, we'll get 3 months of spring, and then it'll be winter again. So but what goes around comes around. And so you're seeing time in repetitions. But those repetitions are not exact. Those repetitions are a resemblance theory. Now, you need repetitious time because resemblance is how you navigate through a world in which identity is a very difficult thing to process. You need to process identity through resemblance. You have to say, this spring looks like last spring. Or when we see something like this, we might be able to expect something else like this, right? So it gives us a kind of way of working through a complex and slippery situation in which we need some kind of predictive measure. And that's what cyclical time does. Now, if you're in a liberation model, you're just trying to get out of the cycle entirely. You're either halting the cycle or freeing yourself from the cycle. Or you think that you're free, so free in the cycle that you can do anything you want. The fourth kind of time is the hard one. And that's what I've already referred to it. It's called recursive time. And it means that the instruction to repeat is built into the instruction. Now, when recursive time works well, it feels like nothing happened because it replaces itself with itself so perfectly, so isomorphically and one-to-one and onto that you don't notice it. But recursive time reminds us that entropy, the movement of order into disorder, is an ordinary thing. Because things don't repeat themselves perfectly, which is why we get wrinkles or why our hair grows old or other kinds of things. Like, we literally get diseased because the process fails to replicate itself perfectly. However, when it does fail to replicate itself perfectly, we're back in the Ganesha story, good things also happen. So when it fails to replicate itself perfectly, bad things happen. Did everybody get that? Because entropy happens and order turns to disorder and things can go amiss and we can get sick because we miss the mark. Right? But if things only stay the same and they repeat themselves perfectly, they can't change. They can't grow. They literally can't evolve because they don't change. So Ganesha is particularly the lord of recursive time. Why? Because he tells you that change can go amiss. Obstacles, thresholds, all that kind of Ganesha language. But he also tells you that unless you're willing to stay capable of change, you can't grow. You can't evolve. So change can go badly for you, change can go really well for you, and the answer is yes. So instead of solving the problem of obstacles, he literally locates you in the paradox of change. You don't want it to change, and it does. You do want it to change, and it won't.
Okay, that's good.
Oh, good. I'm really happy for that, because this wasn't free, and you got to get something out of this. Okay, so... So literally, let me say it again. You don't want things to change, and they do. You do want things to change, and they don't. And then, no matter what you want, they either aren't changing fast enough, or they're changing too fast. And Ganesha's answer to that is, yep. In other words, you don't solve that, you live in it. Liberation solves the problem, right? Love your life, which is what I would call Rajanika, tells you, you just got to figure out that that's always happening. Now, on some ways that prepares you for it, and on some ways you never can be prepared for it, which is part of the other paradox. It's like saying, you know, it's like when you're a little kid, you know, like my dad was 51 when I was born. I was that little boy who loved his father and admired him. I was always worried about, like, I had the old dad. So is my dad gonna die or not? Like, you know, primal boy fear. And yet, so you don't want him to, and yet you can't live without the anxiety that he will. Because it took me a long time to realize that anxiety was a feature of how much I loved him, rather than anything else. So again, a negative emotion like anxiety or fear or anger can be quite luminous because it's pointing to something else. Like, it's pointing to how much you care, or the reason this bothers you is because it's telling you something important that you would otherwise prefer. So we're always working in these models in which we're trying to find some homeostasis. But Ganesha tells you it doesn't stick well. Like, you might have had a lovely lunch, but you will be hungry by dinner. And you either try to get out of that problem, or you try to understand that the best thing to do is puja 6 times a day. That is to say, just keep bringing it out and keep doing it. In other words, and then you have that problem. You can go, that thing you're doing, stop doing that, which is a lot of like how I grew up. I wasn't particularly interested in doing well in school. I was particularly noticing that people who didn't had it a lot harder. Does that make sense? So that thing that they're doing, just don't do that. I didn't have, like, I'm definitely going to do this. I had that thing, don't do that. That would be bad, right? And then there's the other side of it is that thing you're doing, keep doing that. And owning that paradox, that's Ganesha's problem. That's Ganesha's issue. Living in the paradox, rather, you can solve problems. Solving problems is easy because you can either solve them or you can't. Like, problems are like mysteries. They're zeros and ones. They're like success and failure. Problems are success and failure. You did it or you didn't do it, right? But paradox is not success and failure. Greatness, now we're to Mahaganapati. Now we're to Ganesha. Greatness is when you succeed and you fail and you ask a different question. Not whether I succeeded and fail. You ask the question of greatness. Is it worth it? You ask the you turn success and failure into the value question. Because all of us are in some kind of intimacy relationship where the question isn't whether you succeed and fail, because you do that every day. You can have a crazy successful marriage where you get the garbage out and everything happens just right and be miserable, right? Because success can make you miserable. Is everybody clear about that? We all kind of been down that road, right? And failure is even worse, right? So and here's the reality. Most of us succeed and fail every day, right? And then, but the question of greatness isn't how well you succeed or how badly you fail. It's how well you incorporate both. It's integrating it, right? And so you say, integrating it changes the question. It changes the question to, is doing this with all this success and failure worth it to me or is it not? Is it worth the price or is it not? Is it worth the cost or is it not? It's that great moment in Bridge of Spies. Was that the Tom Hanks movie? So they bust the Russian spy and Tom Hanks comes in as the lawyer and he says, you know, they're going to send you to the electric chair. You don't look worried. And the spy looks at him and he goes, would it help? Which is exactly the greatness question. Like, would it help? Because if it would help, I would worry. Yeah. And if it wouldn't help, I wouldn't worry. Right? So, in fact, it doesn't question your morality. It questions your judgment. And now you're asking value questions and making judgment calls. I would call that yoga. I would call that a sadhana. You want a sadhana that teaches us, a practice, that teaches us how to ask the value questions and how to make the judgments. Because we're going to make the So again, the Christians mess us up on this. Because they say, judge not that ye be judged. And the reason they say that is that God does the judging and you don't. Right? So just get God out of the picture for a second and realize that you're making a judgment all the time. And you're either good at it or you're not. And that becomes a different kind of question. So we have a Ganapati for that. We have a Ganesha for that. But before we get to that guy, we'll tell another story. So.
Is the sun in your eyes? I can't see.
If it is, I wouldn't know.
Okay. Would it make any difference?
Yeah, would it make any difference? Probably not.
Not me.
No, it's okay. I don't care. I'm not superior. I'm not immune. I'm just stupid. Like, it's kind of interesting. I'm the kind of guy who would sit in an uncomfortable position until you told me to move.
Like, I'm kind of like that too.
Yeah.
Just keep doing
the one thing I said to my host when we got here, other than thank you and I'm really happy to be here, is that other than what I say here, just tell me what to do. Because here I get to make every decision. And there, and everywhere else, I don't want to make any decisions. Because what do I know about being here? So, defer but never submit. That's good Rajanika teaching. Defer but never submit. Right? Guru traditions, liberation traditions, want you to submit because that person has it and you don't. And if they really had it, you would submit. No submission, just deference. Like, give people who know their thing, their thing. That warrants respect. That warrants honor. Like, you can do that better than me? Please do. Okay, so we now know how he was made, and that's a pretty basic story. We do know something special, though, and that is that the story is going to tell us that we are living in four kinds of time all at the same time. So that in order to excavate in order to break into the unconscious and in order to let the unconscious come forward into our experience, we have to enter mythic time. And mythic time has now been defined for us by the elephant. It's vast. It doesn't need a head, so it doesn't need a purpose or a goal or an agenda, right? Its enormity gets us out of the problem of eternity and infinite and solution. It's broken, so it is itself broken because it doesn't have a head, right? It's incomplete. It's unfinished. The best truth is always unfinished because it means that there could be more truth. Like, nothing's less satisfying than a question with a simple answer.
One thing I always think about that you said once is that Shiva said that, you know, the boy finally got a good head on his shoulders.
Yeah.
I was always trying to figure out what that means.
Well, that means that he gets the head that he gets on his shoulders is, in effect, the only one he could have. And it is broken, and it is deformed. And yet, the reason the boy has a good head on his shoulders is because it's the head that you have on your shoulders is the one that you're going to have to learn to live with. Yeah. Right? And so the goal of the yoga isn't attaining some superior state. It's learning to live with yourself. And that's a completely different agenda. And Ganesha is the god who by all definitions, learns to live with himself. Like, that's his great gift. Good. That's cool. Good. And how to do that? He's going to stand in a certain triad with his other brothers. So we need to get a little bit into that those stories to get back to a Ganesha story. So Ganesha also because he's going to be given the Gunas, like he's going to be Ganapati, Ganesha, the lord of the Gunas. He's going to get the family business, and we already said that that's not just a blessing. That's like the inheritance, and the Gunas are all the unruly things that you can't control in your life. And so you're always trying to control what is beyond your control and you can't control, and that's not a bad thing. You want to have those things like in your purview, but you never will. And that's the Ganesha paradox, is that you want to keep the unruly, uncontrollable, unfinished rabble of your life close enough so that you know it's there, and you know what you can't control, but you actually don't control it, and neither does he. And that's going to come out in further stories. Now, if you go into bhakti traditions or if you go into other tantric traditions, he's got this. The mythological answer in all those traditions is they got this, like, because they're perfect, because they solve the problem, because they aren't subject to conditions, so the conditions have to go away. Now, let's tell the story that makes a mess of all of this, because especially on the internet, it's told with quintessential spiritual bypass, which I submit is what liberation tantra is. It's nothing more than spiritual bypass, because it wants to claim there's a special state. Okay. So, you'll remember that our demon, Rahu, right, was decapitated because he was trying to swallow the moon and he saw what happened to the baby's head, correct? And he's the one who summons Ketu to absorb the head into the talas and navigate their way down. And other beings also see this happen, including the crows and the snakes. So we can divest, we can go a little bit there. The crows are, and the crows turn up everywhere. They turn up in Norse mythology. There's two of them with Odin. The crows are the messengers. And the crows see everything that goes on. And the crows are kind of marginalized and somewhat scary and kind of despised because they're going to bring you the truth. And you don't really want the truth. And the crows also tell you that it's a really dangerous, threatening, and precarious world because tre corvi, right? Italiano, right? Three crows. It's a very...
Tre corvi.
Yeah, they say it all the time. The reason is, if you have crows around you, we have them. We really have great crows where we live. Two in the tree, one on the ground. Two on the ground, one in the tree. In other words, what crows know is that the oneness of their eyes is untenable. Okay, untenable. So here's the mythic image of a crow. In India, a crow doesn't have two eyes. A crow has one eye, and it swivels around. Because it can only look at you like this. And it's called the logic of the crow's eye. And It's actually an important logical and grammatical principle. Again, if there's something interesting, it's always going to be somewhere in the grammar of these weird languages, because these people thought grammar was the way you tear the world apart, because that's what the word grammar means in Sanskrit. So the word for grammar means to rip things to shreds, and the word Sanskrit means to put things together. So you rip things apart in order to put them together. You see how Ganesha that is? Like, you have to decapitate the head to put it back together. But you don't really get your head on right until it's been taken off, because you don't really get your language right until it's been deconstructed by grammar. Now, the grammar has rules, but the genius of the grammar is that it has rules until you figure out how to break the rules. But what the crows know, so one of the rules of grammar, and this is a great rule, is that a word can only function in one way at one time. So you can make similes and allegories and symbolism, but you can only get it to go here or there. So it works like a crow's eye. So when you read a Sanskrit sentence, a word can only function with one verb at a time. These are all little technicalities, but it really is just saying it goes this way or it goes that way. It goes this way or it goes that way. Because the crow doesn't really have two eyes. The crow has one eye that swivels back and forth. That's because the crow needs to see in two directions, in stereo, but it knows that its attention is always focused in one way or another, so we are always blind to our own insight. Get it? As much as we focus and concentrate, there's always something we can't see. So all of our light, so it looks like we see with light and shadow, it looks like we see in stereo, it looks like we see in perspective, but the first lesson of the crow is that we don't. It's that we're actually just one eye swiveling back and forth. Which means that we think we see in stereo. We think we see in depth and perspective. We think, I have a perspective on that, we say, or I have an idea about that. Like, I've thought about that before. I've gained some province on that. And the answer is, actually, by yourself, not so good. Two crows, better. Three crows, see in every direction. Get it? Because now you have, now you not only you have two eyes, you have three eyes. You have three eyes on things. Hence, three crows. Plus, they're looking out for each other. Now, there's another sweetness. This is really great. When you come down in the morning in a Brahmin's house, and it's dark, and there's puja to be done very early, puja's going to start right as the sun, before the sun rises. The sun's going to rise right before 6. It's a 12-hour day in South India, almost year-round. Get down there, take a bath at 3:45 out of a cold bucket. This is my life for 7 years, right? 3:45 in the morning, take a cold bucket bath, come downstairs. My first job is to go find the milkman. Because before I go in the pujama room, that guy's going to be out there with the milk. The first night I did this, I thought I had to milk the cow. I stayed up all night. I was completely freaked out. I'm a kid from New Jersey. I don't have to milk a cow. I soon found out that I didn't have to milk the cow. The kid was out there milking the cow, and his grandfather's standing there, and the cow's standing there. And I just wait for the bucket. Hands me the bucket. I bring it in, right? Who's the first one awake after me in the house? Amma, Appa's wife. She's going to take that milk and bring it to the kitchen, and that's where the real puja is going to begin. Milk's going to be boiled, and rice is going to be cooked. Now, the rice is life, right? Because it's all the fragments, all the broken pieces, and you cook it into one thing, and you eat all the broken pieces, and then it all becomes you again, and then you do it again and again and again. And so rice is life. Rice is incarnation, life. Rice is nourishment. Rice is death. It has to happen again and again. But it has to happen every day, right? And it's the goddess who provides the rice, and it's the goddess who cooks the rice, and the milk has to come at the same time. Then you go into the puja room, and you put all that stuff together, and they're in the kitchen doing that. You know you've really arrived in a Brahmin house when you're not just allowed in the puja room, you're allowed in the kitchen. Like, the day I was allowed all the way in the kitchen, that's the big deal. Because that's the real sanctum. So the rice comes out just as puja is finishing, which is when the sun is rising. So the first puja happens before the sun rises. This happens in the temple. This would happen in a tantric household. Among Brahmins, this happened in my life every day. 3:65, didn't know what day of the week it was, but I did know that we did puja. 4:15 every morning, we start at 3:45. We bathe at 3:45, downstairs at 4 o'clock, get the milk, go to the puja room, 4:15, off to the races. Then the instruction starts, the mantra start, the learning starts, the stories start for another hour. After we're done with the ritual, there's this. another hour of this. This is going to make it 6 o'clock. The rice is going to come out of the kitchen. It's going to enter the puja room, the big bucket of rice that's going to feed the whole family, right, for the day. It's going to come into the puja room. It goes to the gods first. And then, in the puja room, the mother, Appa's wife, will take a handful of rice, like this much, and she'll walk to the front door, and she'll turn around specifically towards the house, and she'll throw it on the roof. Now, she did this for like 6 months before I finally had the nerve to go, okay, what's going on? And finally, I say to her, what's going on? And she says, I'm feeding the crows. And she said, and then I said to Appa, I go, okay, like, feeding the crows, why? And he said, first the gods, then the crows. So it comes from the kitchen, which is grace. It goes, and then grace tangles with self-effort. Like, there's rice in the kitchen, you have to cook the rice, that's self-effort. So grace plus self-effort is practice. You bring that to the gods, that is, you're looking for the best part of yourself, and then you have to make the best part of yourself an offering to the world. The way you make yourself an offering to the world is you go to the threshold where Ganapati would be, and instead of giving it to Ganapati, who's plenty hungry, you give it to the crows before you give it to Ganapati. Before you give it to Ganapati on the outside, you gave it to him in the puja room, but you have to don't give it to him first. Why? Because the crows know everything. The crows have watched everything. The crows know, the crows see you when you're sleeping, they know when you're awake. They know if you've been bad or good, right? And it isn't be good for goodness sake, they just know. So they're gonna tell the stories. And the courage of yoga is that you want to feed the crows because the crows know your story, and the first lesson of your story is don't be angry. Don't be hangry, neither hungry or angry. And if you're hungry, you are angry. So the first lesson is feed the gods, feed your demons, just bloody feed everybody. Because as soon as that happens, you can have the next sane conversation, which is whatever the message is today, I need to know it. I need to spread it. I need to give my message. And the crows receive the messages, offer the messages, converse the messages. We can't have yoga unless we enter into conversation with a world greater than ourselves. We step outside, the crows are connected to the world greater than ourselves. So the crows are the messengers of the sky, the snakes are the messengers of the underworld. Because they're both good at watching, they're both good at waiting, they're both good at delivering the message, whether you like it or not. Whether it's, the snake's venom is digestion for food, right? It's creating food, it's the hunt, but it's also danger, it's also protection, and it's also just venom. Like, so it's every message. So the crows and the snakes deliver every message. They are the harbingers and the gift givers of the myths. Both crows and snakes see the decapitation. They know what happens to the baby's head too. Mm. So, once upon a time, in eons before, the gods and the demons decide enough is enough. We have to collaborate well enough to recreate the world. And this begins the story of what we call the Milky Ocean. The gods take the tail. The gods and the demons both invite Vasuki, the king of the serpents. They take Mount Mandara, which is really Mount Kailasa, and they turn it upside down, and they make Vasuki the churning stick. So they're going to make the peaked mountain. They're going to turn that. See where we're going. They're going to turn this way, into a downward facing triangle. That should look like something else. This should look like something else. They're going to take a masculine encoded world that's penetrating. And they're going to turn it into a womb, right? And they're going to use that to penetrate down because they want to churn the world like butter, like on both sides. And the reason the gods choose the feet, the tail, is because they're deferential. See, the demons think that taking the king of the snakes by his head and pulling on it, like they've got the better part. They've got the powerful part. But in fact, it's the feet, because the snake's doing you a job. Like, he's doing you a service. And you always honor the people who do for you what you can't do for yourself. So in fact, the gods, by taking the deferential position at the tail of the snake, have the superiority. The gods and the demons, however, are collaborating, and they're going to churn the world. Now, the ocean, like the forest, like a bunch of other things, is a symbol of consciousness and all the forms of consciousness, but particularly the depths of the ocean are the unconscious. Right? So they have to churn everything from the bottom up to recreate the world, with the churn consciousness. Now, lots of good stuff happens, and bad stuff happens. So we get, for example, the Kamadhenu, the wish-fulfilling cow. We get the little swirl on Vishnu's chest, his little like handsome hair thing, his little Brad Pitt moment. We get a coral tree, which is quite beautiful. We get Kastuvi, which is the jewel that grows in the middle of the lotus of Vishnu's navel. These all have various symbolic qualities. But then we get two things when we kind of get down to the bottom of the ocean. We get a toxicity called hullahull, right? And hullahull is this blue poison stuff. And the very name of it is the onomatopoetic sound of choking. So hullahull is that's what the word means. Yeah. Now that story is going to take us down the path that Shiva is observing this project. And the gods are going to call upon Shiva to take the hullahull and to suspend it in his throat, and so become the blue-throated one. Right? There's actually a bird in Uttarakhand called a Nilakanta. Ask the guide or someone if you haven't seen one before. But it's this squat little brown bird with a white belly, but it's got a bright blue throat. It's a bird. It's a bird. It's a bird because of snakes. Okay, so, and not even Shiva can digest this toxicity. That's a crucial part of our whole bigger story, because there are toxicities in the world that are indigestible. When they're masculine encoded, they have to be suspended. So in masculine encoded reformulations of self, right, we learn to take the things that are most toxic and hold them in abeyance. Or as Randall's Kentucky ancestor would say to him, son, you don't have to say everything you ever thought. Right? You just leave it in your throat. Right? Because it might do more harm than good. Right? Did I get that right, Ron? Okay, why not? Thanks. He's really good at this. So.
Your advice to Bernie.
Exactly.
Say it, but
don't say it.
Okay.
Yeah, just don't say it. Like, there's some things don't say. Because you don't want the toxicity out, because you can't, because no take backs, no do overs. See how it goes? So, whereas when the goddess swallows comparable poisons, she transmutes them. So she doesn't just swallow them, she redigests them. And they're going to come out. She's going to birth demons and gods from transmuted poison. The goddess transmutes. She's the alchemizer. So you have to take the horrors of your life and turn them into something else. That's goddess tradition. You have to take things that are horrible in your life and suspend them. That's God tradition. Get it? And the answer is Samelana. Don't fail to do both. Like, don't go God is good, Shiva bad. Don't do that. Silly. You need to do, these are very different tasks. When to just keep the toxicity safe, because it's got to go somewhere, and when to try to turn it into something else, which could cause you a lot of aggravation. But Goddess knows how to do that, because she's going to endure, not die from it. Goes back to heroes and heroines. Heroes die for the cause, heroines don't. Heroes suffer the cause, goddesses alchemize. Heroines, goddesses alchemize the cause. See how it works? Follow these patterns, the myths start to come really clear to you. Okay, so this stuff comes up. Yeah, and Shiva holds it in suspension. However, the soma also comes. So the amrita comes. Because we get all this stuff, but we get the poison, and then we get the elixir. Like, we get the good stuff. This is what Rahu wants. This is what the gods want. And this is what the demons want. And the demons are going to get it, because they outnumber the gods by gerrymandering and voter suppression and all the other means in which, by minority status, they still manage to hold power. Okay? So, I got to get a little dig in. So, the soma comes, and the gods are going to get it. And Rahuketu, who's still together, is going to get the soma. He's just about to do that. And Vishnu appears in the form of Mohini, M-O-H-I-N-I. Moha means delusion, and Mohini means the delicious little delusion. Like all those eeny endings, like zucchini, are really delicious little zooks. So, like, this eeny ending in Sanskrit works like chiquita. Like, it doesn't mean little girl, it means I want some of that. Right? It means like, it means delectable, sweet. There's a sweetness to it, but a sensuality to it, and a kind of naughtiness to it. Mohini is the thing you can't resist. Everybody's got one where you just go, I want some of that. Like, it doesn't matter. Mohini also involves the Zappos rule. Does everyone know the Zappos rule? Has anybody got a shoe fetish? Come on, just say yes, you're Italian. Right? The Zappos rule is you are not allowed to hit enter after 9 p.m. because you don't really need those shoes. You're just soothing yourself. Get it? It's just a Mohini. It's just like, whatever it is, like, this, come on. Somebody in this room, my wife calls me a hoarder. I rather think of it as archivist. But it's that thing that when you want one, you want six. Get it? And everybody's got one. And if you think you're in some spiritual garage sale where you're always giving away your stuff, like, you know, you have that whole shelf of books that says, keep it simple, give away your world. I can tell you is you and John Calvin have a really good relationship because that's just Protestant renunciation, okay? Because as soon as you dispatch all that stuff you have, you're going to need a storage unit after you come home from vacation, okay? It's a George Carlin joke. You left to leave your stuff, and you came home with more stuff, and now you need a place to put your stuff, okay? And giving all of that up is nonsense. So because the things that you want, you really want. And that things that you fetish for and ache for, you really like. And the answer is, don't not have that. The answer is, you've got that. I wonder how that's going to work out for you. So it doesn't answer a problem. It just addresses a truth. And that everybody's, like when Liv Tyler put on the elf ears, you know, in Lord of the Rings, I was all over that, man. I was like, wow. Elves meet Vulcans. I'm hot for that. Like, totally, I can't resist. And I was just doing Norse myths. And one of the features of Norse myths is that, especially the way the Thor myths all begin, they all begin with, like, what a beautiful, irresistible, like, luscious guy he is. And one of the students raised her hand and said, what's all this emphasis on appearance? And I said, are you kidding me? This is the September issue of Vogue. Everybody waits for that. Because hotness is a category. And it's a primal category, and it's a category everybody has. Do you want me to tell the hotness story? I will anyway. I'm at a yoga conference. It's kind of hilarious. This is a Ganesha story. And I'm at a yoga... We go till what time?
7.
Oh, we're great. I'm at a yoga conference, and I'm going to do one of these tag team yoga things with someone who wasn't in Anasara who none of us know. and she's going to like do the asana and I'm going to do the tag team. So she's going to get you in like Natarajasana, which is impossible, or Vashistasana, and I'm going to keep you in Vashistasana for 20 minutes while I tell you who Vashishta is. Like, remember when we used to do this? This was hilarious. Okay. So, yeah. I'd give you like these super lectures while you're in a yoga asana. And I would genuinely try to torture you. Like, keep you just a little too long, like he's talking too much, like I am right now. Okay, so this yoga teacher who none of us knows has a really incredibly ripped, beautiful, handsome boyfriend who has come to play the little harmonium invocation before the gig. And he shows up in blue jeans and a t-shirt to do that. She starts in good old-fashioned Anusara fashion by saying, we need a demo to start this class. She calls the boyfriend to the center of the room, right? Who's not prepared for this, was given no predilections that this was gonna happen, nothing, right? And she wants to do the good dog, bad dog, and she's smart because she wants the really proficient yogi to show you how not to do the posture because you could hurt yourself. So she wants to do good dog, bad dog, you know, that kind of, you've been through this, right? You're alignment people, you're yoga people, right? So, and then she goes, please take off your shirt. So now he's ripped in tight blue jeans with his t-shirt off in the middle of a room that looks a lot like this one, right? It's like 9-1 women to men, right? And they're standing around and she's giving this completely straight up demo and I'm sitting on the side and the entire room is doing this. Like they're completely seduced. They're out of their minds. Right? Mohini has arrived. And Mohini is in the middle of the room and he's hip to it. Like he knows I'm laughing. He knows this is what's going on. He knows that no one in the room is looking at his yoga posture. They're just looking at his junk. Like they are all over this. And he's got really hot junk, right? Like hotness is real, right? So he sits down, he comes back, his t-shirt sitting next to me. Comes back, he puts his shirt on, he's sitting next to me, like right next to me, and he looks at me and goes, what was that? Like he sussed out the whole thing. Meanwhile, the class goes on, and I look at him and I go, even I want to fuck you. Because Mohini's real. You get the point? Like it really is. Like hotness is a category, and everybody's vulnerable. Everybody. Everybody. And then he goes like this. It's a true story. Can't make it up. And I could tell you that guy's name, but you already know it. So Mohini is real. So Mohini shows up at the Milky Ocean, and Rahu, who's about, as Rahu Ketu, is about to swallow the soma, except Lasya happens. Mohini goes, hey, baby, and Rahu Ketu for a moment looks this way, right? Vishnu, who is also Mohini, takes his discus, which is called looking good, Sudarshana, and decapitates Rahu Ketu because there's the Lasya again. Get it? So Vishnu's in two forms. He's in the form of a woman who's irresistible, the Chikita Mohini, and he's in the form of himself, and he throws the discus. In the meantime, Shiva's got a throat full of poison, and he sees the whole thing. One of the MOs of the Shiva Parvati story is that Shiva looks like he doesn't have interest in anyone else because he doesn't. Like, he's a swami. He mostly, like, so she always thinks, like, man cave guy. He only has eyes for me. He doesn't really have eyes for anything. Like, he doesn't evince that much interest in anybody else. And definitely, I have the Lasya, and I'm all over this guy. So that's Parvati's MO in the beginning of the Ganesha story. But Shiva has seen Mohini. Shiva has seen Mohini.
Hey.
Is Shiva invulnerable?
Hmm.
Break down capital letters again. Shiva's supernal superior state might be broken into by his own experience of Mohini. Fast forward, somewhere in quadratic time, right? Fast forward, there are these sages in a forest. They are paving paradise and putting up a parking lot. So they are violating a big yellow taxi rule. And that is that the far... You like this, Devin. You're having a good time with the story. It's kind of a modern rendition, but we're working on it. Okay? So there are these sages, and they've gone to the forest because they got what we've got. Like, if we get re-election, I'm moving to the Falklands. Because the Falklands is the only place in the world where I'm sure the weather is worse than where I live, and no one will go there. So I'm not going to Costa Rica with the rest of you expats. I'm getting the fuck out of here, okay? I'm going with the sheep into the South Atlantic, okay? So I'm joking. Has everybody got this? So these guys, these cats, they're called the Tilai Forest Sages, the Pine Forest Sages. They're like, we're out of here. We're going to go to the most forbidding, unwelcoming, difficult place. We'll get to do the tapas. We'll get to do the whatever it takes to get here. We'll get to do the yoga. The sadhana is really hard. We're going to bring our wives, which is kind of weird, but they're going to do that too. And we're out of here. And they go to the forest. And the problem is that everyone needs that forest, because in that forest is where you keep all of us, right? Our fugitives, our runaways, our skeletons, our regrets. This forest includes that trunk that you still have, that shoebox you still have somewhere in your life with the photographs of exes, okay? And you thought you threw all of that out, and I promise you, you still have some, okay? So, as diligent as you have, purging your regrets, they are deeply present somewhere in a shoebox inside the closet of your own consciousness, okay? Your shadows remain, all right? Now, you need that place where you can lock that stuff up where you kind of know where it is, so that when you take it out, you're okay, right? You need a closet for your skeletons, and you need to know when to open it and when to close it, and what's in there and what's not, vaguely. You need to like walk away from it and get on with your life and just keep it in the closet. This is all good Rajanika yoga. Like, what's not the con job? The con job is you're filled with a life of experiences and regrets and harms and shadows and things you wish you didn't do and things you actually would rather hide, pieces of privacy. It doesn't matter, but we've all got stuff that we need in a shoebox in a closet, locked away. And once in a while, we open it up, we take it out, we deal with our stuff, we put it away, we think we throw it away. The reason not to throw it away is you're gonna think about it after you threw it away, okay? So you're gonna live with it, but you don't have to live with it all the time. That's crazy, right? That's just driving yourself mental. So don't, right? But the idea is when to take out your shadow and when not, and when to open it up and when not to. That's critical to the story. So these sages go to the forest, and the forest is that place. Now, they want to domesticate the forest. They want to run away from the world. No. The forest is like snowbirding a little. You really don't want those tourists here all year. You want them here long enough to like make a dime on them and see them leave. Is everybody clear about that? You're very clear about that, right? So you're the light, but you're really somebody else's shadow because they're wigged out about the weather. I get that. I live in the wigged out weather. I just don't come here for that. So these guys, in fact, are kind of in the forest, and they're being very successful. They're so successful that they're doing their pujas all day, and they're domesticating the forest. The denizens of the forest don't want them there, much like real Floridians, right? And because they don't really belong there, and they're kind of opening up too much space, they're going to stay there. And so they send messages, right? The crows see this, the snakes see this, right? The other creatures of the forest see this. And they are going to tell a certain special form of Hanuman, who's also in that forest. And the reason he's in that forest is that he's a mess too. He's a mess because his mother was raped by the wind. There are other whole sets of stories for why the five-faced Hanuman is in the forest. Okay, but he's a forest guy, and we're going to see him in the forest. We're going to see him in lots of forests. We get different names for different forests, so we're going to see him in the Ramayana in a very different forest than this forest. But they're all kind of sectors of the same big forest, and the forest is consciousness. And the darkest parts of the forest are the unconscious, where you try to forget and store away and put away all your secrets and all your shadows and all your stuff. And even the stuff you don't even know is there, right? Like, you know, the day mama didn't pick you out of the crib fast enough and you're still working it out. And don't even know you're doing it, right? All of that's there. So this message gets back to Vishnu, because Vishnu is there to make sure the world works right, and Vishnu knows we need a place to store ourselves. We need a forest of toxicity. Now, we can go on with this story in much more detail, but we won't. Fast forward, Vishnu comes to Shiva and says, we got to do something about this. We have to get these guys out of the forest. Shiva says, and then Vishnu goes, in the meantime, Vishnu goes, why are you so naked, bro? Like, what happened? Because I got in a fight with the girl, we played a little dice, I ended up naked in a game. So it's a kind of post-dice game story. And Shiva is Bhikshatana, he's the beautiful beggar. Bhikshatana, if you don't know what a word means in Sanskrit, it means Brahmin, elephant, or body. Seriously, like you're in the Sanskrit exam and you don't know what that word is, land on one of those three things, you're probably right. Because Sanskrit's like 900 words for body, elephant, and Brahmin. Seems to be the thing they were thinking about most. Okay? So Bhikshatana, beautiful, beggar's body. But this means he's buck naked and he's like that guy in the yoga room. He's the beautiful guy. So he says to Vishnu, you should go back to being Mohini. We'll go into this forest. You will distract the sages because you're irresistible. And I will distract their wives. And let's cause a little ruckus in the forest. And that will start something. So Bhikshatana, the beautiful beggar, and Mohini walk into the forest. And the first thing that happens is the forest sage's wives are in the yoga class. Because Bhikshatana is in tight jeans, he's just taken off his t-shirt, and they are all over it. Now, the beautiful part of this story is that once we enter the Tamil versions of these stories, which are largely untranslated, and you have to just trust me on this, because this is a really important point, is that the first time I read through this particular long passage in Tamil, I didn't quite believe what I was reading, because my Tamil's solid, written literary Tamil from the 11th century, I'm okay. But I still have to like go, is that really what it says? Whereas the Sanskrit stories don't, like, I can, anyway, I'm reading this and I'm going, WTF. And the reason is because the description of what the forest sages' wives are doing is beyond credulity. They're commenting on the enormity of his junk, and then they're variously going through all the postures and deeds that they are variously offering in order to like entice him into their particular hut. Yes, and it's this, it's so salacious and fantastically lascivious and over the top. You can't, like, you're just weeping in laughter because they're like, well, they're like all over this guy. In the meantime, and they're trying to touch him, and this is important, and they can't, and he's evading their touches because he's the beautiful beggar and because he's Shiva and he belongs to Parvati, and he's just doing this just to mess with them. And this is the beginning of Nataraja. He's dancing to avoid the salacious touch of the wives. He's not dancing for ecstasy. He's actually dancing to avoid the ecstasy that they're promising him. And they are in lurid detail. Someday I will. I promise I will translate every sentence in lurid detail. It's hilarious, okay? But the first dance is he won't let them touch him. Then Mohini walks in, and this is just enough to give the sages who are over here, because they're not, because what's happened is their success in the forest has estranged their intimacy. That wouldn't sound like any marriage anybody else has had, would it? Like, their success at getting the world together means that they don't do it anymore. So the wives are over here and the sages are over there, and this is success, right? So, but she walks in, which is really a he, because it's really Vishnu, but he's really Vishnu in the form of a woman. And of course, what happens? Well, the sages go, like that, because she's him. But then they realize that their wives are doing this other thing over there, and they break from Mohini. Because jealousy and envy and anger and fear has re-engaged their passion for their wives. So they break the Mohini spell. They then attack Bhikshatana, Shiva, and then we get a second dance, evading their mantras and evading their missiles, because they're trying to destroy him. The women are exhausted from trying to seduce him, and the sages are exhausted from trying to defeat him. And then in utter exhaustion, they all just collapse. Fast forward 900 steps in the story, the sages and the wives cut a deal, and Shiva says, they go, well, who are you and what's this about? And Shiva says, Shiva gives them straight up Michael Corleone. Like, the deal is, you've got to leave the forest. And I'm going to make you a deal you can't refuse. So you're going to leave this forest, but you're going to be reborn into heaven. And when you come back, you're going to get to see me dance all over again. And you're going to, it's going to be good. So for now, please leave. Because they're trying to clean out the forest so that you can keep all your skeletons there. And these guys are domesticating the undomesticatable. Don't do that. Don't domesticate your shadows. Bad, bad yoga, not good yoga. Don't make excuses for them. Don't take them out in inappropriate ways. Don't mention them when they don't need to be mentioned. Don't try to ignore them. All these are all ways of domesticating your shadow, you see? You try to make yourself okay with it. It's never okay. It just belongs in a certain place, and you learn how to deal with it, right? Okay, so that's the deal. But here's the really fun part. On the way out, Shiva can't resist Mohini. Now, Shiva's MO is disinterest or only Parvati. Mohini, who is really Vishnu, is Parvati's brother. But bada bing, bada bum. Vishnu returns to Vaikuntha, to heaven, where he can no longer sustain the delusion. He returns to Vaikuntha in heaven. He lays down on Adi Shesha, the primordial remainder. Stop there. Important point. Vishnu's name means everything. And yet there's this thing that is called primordial extra. Why? Because everything includes an extra missing and a broken piece. You see, everything is never everything. Everything is always plus one, minus one, more, less. It's all Ganesha's head. Get it? It's all extra pieces laying around everywhere. Okay? He lays down on Adi Shesha, who's like the sleep comfort bed. And the snake says, five-headed serpent, says to Vishnu, why are you so weighty? Why are you so heavy? And then why are you so agitated? So he's both this, excited, and this, weighty. And Vishnu says, I have seen the Lord dance. Well, no kidding. Because this is going to start the cycle where the snake says, I want to see the Lord dance too. And he's going to say, you're going to have to go and become human and do these other, or at least partially human. And this is going to begin the cycle that we call Patanjali. That's going to start that part of the story. However, what Vishnu's really doing is he's getting the snake out of the way. Because he returns, he lays down on the snake, he's Vishnu, and he's pregnant with Shiva's child. Not good. Because this is now here's the important part of the story, and it deeply connected to the Ganesha story. This is ultimate betrayal. Like fine line betrayal. Because he's pregnant with his sister's husband's son. Well, it's gonna be a son.
Child.
Yeah, right. Because she, Vishnu, is Shiva's wife, Parvati's brother. Brothers are supposed to protect sisters, not get knocked up by their husbands. But myth always saves us because the husband is knocked up. This is important to the Ganesha myth. Why?
This is only Ganesha's brothers?
Hang on, man. We're onto it. You're exactly onto it. So, next thing's going to happen. Vishnu's pregnant. And we're going to have a John Hurt alien problem here. Because we got no way out. We got no way out. And, point one. Point two, there's only one person who knows the way out. Who would that be? Parvati. She's the mother of the universe. And point three, everybody needs a mother. So Parvati's going to have to find out. Then she's going to find out that her brother is knocked up by her husband. Right? Who she never thought would betray her. This way, right? Which is why when he leaves at the end of the Ganesha story, she doesn't care. She goes, okay, you leave, right? She goes, she wins the dice game. She says, okay, you leave. And then she makes the Ganesha, I don't need you. But part of her subconscious point is he doesn't cheat. He has no other interest. Like, I've got this. Now, that's not true because even Shiva is vulnerable to Mohini. From the previous story. And the person who she's most entrusted, who has always protected her interest, Vishnu, is in fact pregnant with the child. So she has to deal with all of this. This, you might, now, on the internet, she's like, and it was all fine and everybody agreed. Right? Like, that's going to be internet yoga. Promise you. That's kind of not what the texts say. The texts say she's a little annoyed. She's so annoyed that she's going to go to the forest of toxicity, right, where all of this happened, and she's going to become Tillai Kali, the most badass, enraged, furious, crazed, like she's sorrowful, she's angry, she's betrayed, she's horrified. In that forest, she's going to be espied by a creature of the forest who's sitting in the boughs of the Tillai trees. And he's wearing what's called a patya. He's wearing a yoga strap. And he watches her. And he's going to come down and talk to her. And he's going to try to persuade, to tell her that his story, and tell her his story as a kind of consolation. Like everyone who comes here has a hard story. Like this is what this cat knows. Like this cat lives in the trees, and he watches everybody. And everybody who comes in distraught and riven apart and horrified gets watched out.
Viagrapada?
No, this not Viagrapada, but it's a lot like Viagrapada because he's in Viagrapada's forest. Viagrapada is a sage whose name means tiger paws. It's this guy we don't quite know yet. And he's there, and he watches this all happen. And one of the things he does is he tells demons from gods, and he tells good people from bad people. He's a magnificent character because he's a watcher. And he sort of susses out people's real motives. Like he looks at what they do, he looks at what they say they do, and then he decides what's great about them? Like, are they honest? Are they authentic? Like, what are they working out? Because everybody's working out something, and even the demons need a little help. And he helps everybody, gods, demons, because everybody's got a story, and everybody needs to have that story told. And everybody needs someone to tell that story to. Because if you have your secrets and your shadows, and you keep it all bottled up, you don't have anybody you can tell your stories to, you're in serious trouble. So you need a therapist or a best friend. And that's what happens in the forest. And you're counting on that person to be your vault, right? To hold your secrets, which are dangerous to you, right? So this cat shows up, and he always starts the story by saying, I know why you're here. And she says, you can't possibly know why I'm here. And then he begins to tell his story. Then, but in the back of her mind, like her gun is rolling around, she has to decide if she's going to help Vishnu or not, because otherwise Vishnu's going to explode. This conversation, which would now take us a while to explain, between this mysterious character who sits in the trees watching and comes down to console, let's call those consolations, confidences, conversations, right, of Kali. She decides, and she goes through a whole process of deciding how that she is going to help Vishnu. When we go to the Telai Kali temple and circumambulate the temple, each place in the temple is a different part of that story. So the story literally tells the problematic of the betrayal of Parvati by her husband in Vishnu. And the foremost image when you walk in the temple is called Brahma Chamunda Chamundeshwari. Brahma Chamunda Ishwari. So Ishwari, the empowered form, the goddess, who is Brahma, expansive. But Chunda and Munda, this is a little secret that takes you further down other storytelling rabbit holes. Chunda and Munda are two demons of a very old goddess story. And so she's really saying, my brother and my husband are the new Chunda and Munda. They're the new demons in my story. Right? And we have a goddess named Chamundi.
I was just going to say, I say a mantra is Chamunda
and Che. Exactly. Because Chamundi is Chunda and Munda. It's the name of two demons.
I thought it was the moon. Like.
No, it's not Chandra. No.
No, it's Chamundaye, which is.
Yeah, Chamundaye.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a dative ending in the feminine. It means two Munda and Chunda.
Okay.
And that Chamunda is a compound that names the two demons. And demons are always named, almost always, not always, but they're often named a syllable apart when they're twins. Because they're incest, because it's symbolic incest. Like Chunda and Munda, they're only a syllable apart. So they're too close. Things are either too close or too far apart. That's what makes them demons. If you keep things too tight, that's suffocation, that's demon. Keep things too far apart, that's denial, that's demon. So you want them neither too far nor too far apart. So demons are always too close or too estranged. You estrange your demons or you are suffocated by your demons. So demons themselves in the stories are usually very disparate, like they come from different directions, or they're only a syllable apart. Symbolically, it always works this way. So she's reassociating this previous story about her defeat of these two demons. This is in the famous Devi Mahatmya, the Durga Saptashati. Cheryl can tell you those stories. It's famous stories where she defeats demons, Shumbha, Nishumbha, Chandamunda. These are all very, very old goddess stories. But here, the reassociation is that that's Shiva and Vishnu because they did the same thing, this bad thing. But she's going to have to deliver this child. She's going to need all the means to deliver this child. And now we're back to the Ganesha story where it's really fascinating. What she figures out is she's going to need a special instrument to deliver the child. So before, she wiped the ointment off her own body to fashion the child. Here, she's going, because it's not her own body, she can't touch it like that. It would be too much, because the pregnant body is her brother. Too much intimacy, right? Too much intimacy. So what she's going to need is a special instrument. The whole story has to do with her acquisition of that, and it's going to be that thunderbolt of Lord Indra. She's going to need that. But what she figures out is that since there's no way out, where is this child of Vishnu coming from? It's coming out her pores, out his pores. Get it? And she's going to have to scrape it off with essentially a carving knife in the form of a thunderbolt. So what is she doing? This is critical to the Ganesha story. She is reopening the wound of her own creation of Ganesha. She's payback. This is payback. Because she created the Ganesha without conversation, without consent, without consensuality, right? Without communication. She just did it. And now she has to face that, literally see it, do it again. But now to create a child who, by the way, is innocent. The child is innocent. The child is not the villain. That child is going to be called the golden child. His name in Tamil and in Malayalam is Ayyappa. A-Y-Y-A-P-P-A. Now.
How do you spell that?
A-Y-Y-A-P-P-A. Ayyappa. In Sanskrit, we're going to call him Dharma Shasta, or sometimes just Shasta. S-H-A-S-T-A. Atta Yoga Anushasana, it's the same verb. It means to teach or to be learned. So he's going to be called Dharmashastra, learned in Dharma. Hang on for that a second. But he's literally going to be created by being scraped from the ointments of his mother, who's really Vishnu. He's going to have to be fashioned into a child. And because he's golden, because he's innocent, so he has to be mothered into being, because Vishnu can't do this by himself. And she has to see the whole Ganesha story replayed before her eyes. Now, here's the really wonderful thing about that elephant that we started the story with, too, in the four kinds of time. The guy in the tree who sees her come into the forest to go through this whole process of, am I going to do this? I wouldn't even know how to do this. How am I going to deal with my brother, my husband, and how would I deliver the child? All of those things are all the gunas racing through her head, like all those problems. The person who's talking to her, who comes down from the tree, is Ayyappa. He's already there. He's already there because time doesn't work in only one way. You see? So, and now what we know is that he's there and he lives in the forest. Well, why? Well, because she agrees to do this. But then Vishnu and Shiva and her have to make a deal. And that is, we now have this son that is kind of the embodied, he's embodied sweetness, he's goodness, he's the golden child, he's the nicest guy in the world, he's the most genteel character. Like, he's a beautiful character. How can he not be? His father is Vishnu Mohini, his father is Shiva. He's this non-binary object. But he can't be on the scene. He has to be hidden away. He's the bastard child. He gets sent to the ashram of Vyagrapada, the place of wayward boys deep in the forest.
Oh, there's Vyagrapada.
There's Vyagrapada, you see? He gets sent back into the forest. Now, what's that? Exactly, because he is already there. You see how it's linear, but it's not? Like, he's sent there, but it's not? In other words, everything that's going to happen has already happened, and then what's happening is foretelling. Appa used to say, the present comes from the future in the form of the past.
I say that all the time still. I learned that from you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he used to say, like sunlight. That was the first time he taught it, and then he walked away. And I had no idea what he meant. Took me like 8 years before I asked him. And the idea is that the sunlight comes from 8 minutes away. So it's already old. It's coming from the past. But you experience it in the present. It's coming from the future. You experience it in the present as the past. Because it's already past. Yeah. So this child is kind of given up. He's given to the forest. And he's going to be raised by this sage named Tiger Paws. Who's got a whole bunch of other issues going on in the forest. But this is the forest long after those other sages were exiled. Okay, this is that same forest, or we don't know. Now, the key is this. Oh, in the meantime, between Ganesha and Ayyappa, there's already been a second son. So Ayyappa's going to be three, not two. The second son, in Tamil, we call Muruga, M-U-R-U-G-A. In Sanskrit, we call him Skanda. Now, we need all three of these to do tomorrow, and we need this to finish today, because we'll pull it together. What happened is, in a completely different set of stories, there's a new demon. This new demon requires new measures. The gods pool their resources, including the goddesses and everyone. They all get together, and they ask, and they say to Shiva, we need a new prince. We need a new warrior. And Indra, especially the king of the gods, is keen on the idea that the old ways won't work. There's a new virus in town, and we don't have the means to address it. We're going to need new technology. Shiva throws six sparks out of his third eye. They're so powerful that they can't be held. Ganga agrees to hold them, and this becomes the six-faced god. One more face than Shiva, because Shiva represents the new old gods. Indra's the old gods. We're going to need a new prince who has one more face of Shiva, because he's going to have to teach Shiva and everyone else how to destroy this demon. So, this god is so volatile that he has six faces, and he's going to be raised by the Kritikas. He's going to be raised by the goddesses who are the stars of the Pallades, who are called the Kritikas. And he's going to be called Skanda, but in the south we call him Muruga. Now, Ganesha, this is the important part. Ganesha is called Ganapati, right? Ganesha. He gets the family business. Muruga enters the story now to do this very specialized, one might say, military work. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But he's actually fulfilling another role. He's the spare instead of the heir. He's Harry, not William. Mm-hmm. And like Harry, he's going to not be terribly comfortable hanging around the house, because he's not really anywhere in line. Like, what the hell is he doing there? And he might want his own life. And that's where those stories are going to go. Right? But if Ganesha is Ganapati, Muruga is called Senapati, S-E-N-P-A-T-I. He's the lord of the armies. Now, if you're the gods, you're supposed to be like the American government that we're supposed to admire. And that is, we only pull out the military as a kind of threat, but we don't really mean to use it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, we're really nice to you, don't fuck with us. Right? And that's exactly the model they're creating. They want this Muruga to be over here, and he's going to have his own stories and his own issues and his own things, but basically, he's the threat of danger. Like, he's your enforcer, but you're the god, so you almost never use him. Get it? And you don't really want to use him, which leads him down another path of stories. Now, and he's legit. So we have this scene in South Indian mythologies, and this is all over the temples, and it's important. It's called Soma Skanda, S-O-M-A, Skanda, S-K-N-D-A, right? Which is the name of this Muruga character. Now, Soma doesn't mean Soma here. That's a little misleading. It sounds like the name of the moon, which sounds like the elixir, but it's not that word. It's actually a completely different thing. It's a Sanskrit trick. It means the correct analysis of the compound is Sa-Uma Skanda. Sa, as a prefix in Sanskrit, means with. That's all it means. So Sa-Uma turns into Soma grammatically. Uma is the name of the goddess. Okay. The name of the goddess when?
When she sighs?
Yes. Yes. Uma is the onomatopoetic sound of your own breath. Now, Shiva's playing dice. He's going to win. When she does the Lasya, what does he do? He sighs. He says her name. Get it?
Yeah.
And by saying her name, he's broken apart, because he's in love. Because she makes him sigh.
That's beautiful.
Right? So with Uma and Skanda meaning Muruga. Now, if Skanda is mentioned, he's second son. That means Ganesha is in the picture. So, Soma Skanda is a family portrait. Shiva is seated in an anthropomorphic form, usually one leg up, one leg down. Sitting next to him is Parvati, right? This is the reconciled family portrait. This is all over South Indian temples, right? And Ganesha is usually at their feet, like eating laddus or playing with the mouse or doing some Ganesha thing, right? And Skanda is either nursing or somewhere nearby. Who's not there? Ayappa isn't there. Shasta isn't there. But Shasta's the third brother, because he's the illegitimate one who got sent to the forest. He got like sent to the forest because he can't be in the family portrait. He's just not allowed in the family portrait. Like, they can't cope. He's really their shadow. Like, he's the story they don't want to tell. Now, he's going to have his own stories. Now, to connect the Ganesha myth and call it a night, right? So, the baby head at the decapitation seeks down into the earth. But who sees it? The snakes see it on the way down, and the crows see it from the top. This means that the snakes and the crows have their own sanctuary, which is in the forest. And who do they talk to? They talk to the Lord. And so Ganapati gets the family business, Senapati gets the army, and Bhutapati gets the ghosts. Ayappa gets sent to the forest to take care of the demons, because everybody's being taken care of. Ganesha is the Lord of Dharma, the Lord of big things, upfront and extroverted, the thing that holds the world together, which is one pretty problematic place, right? Wounded, broken, put back together. Murga, Skanda, is the Lord of the armies, right? His job is Maya. He comes out when he needs to. In South India, we call him Shatavana. Shata means reeds, like in those big tanks, but it also means arrows. And so he's called Shatavana, meaning the forest of reeds. So when he's doing this, he's watching you. But Ganesha's always, so here's the punchline is very beautiful. Ganesha's the elephant in the room in every story. When you need the elephant, and the elephant is whatever in the room, that's the big overt thing. Like at a wedding, the elephant is love or relationship. At a funeral, it's death. Right? Whatever is the elephant in the room, that's Ganesha. And you want that to be overt. You want it to be unmistakable. Because once you understand what's really at stake and the big thing in the room, Dharma then happens. You can say, okay, how do we hold this together? For better or for worse. Like, are we celebrating? Are we grieving? Are we loving? What are we doing? Right? But Ganesha becomes the tantric Ganesha when you can say to yourself, what do we have to do to hold the world together? Because that's what the word Dharma means. How does Ganesha hold together? Ganesha holds it together because his little brother, Murga, right, is this guy. And he's going to make Maya. He's going to let things, he's going to watch, he's going to aid Ganesha by being this threat. Like, Ganesha wants you to, like, Ganesha's sweet, Ganesha can handle everything, right? Because he's got Murga on the hilltop, which is one of his names, being the prince, saying, if you don't pay attention to my brother Ganesha, you're going to have to deal with me. So, and notice how this archetype plays out. Ganesha is Gimli, and Murga is Legolas. Ganesha is Bhima, and Murga is Arjuna. Get it? Like, one is the archetype of the jovial, hairy, good-natured, axe-wielding, organic elephant. Get it? And Tolkien made him the dwarf, right? And the other is the hilltop, reed-dwelling, Maya-conjuring elf, the long, pointless Orlando Bloom stares of the beautiful character, right? And so you get this, you get the king being this kind of remarkable, organic, happy character, Ganesha. How can Ganesha execute Dharma so, as we see him, like, so sweetly, so justly, so appropriately, so carefully? And the answer is his brother Murga is doing this with this, right? His brother Murga is like, mess with the big guy and the ninja's coming for you. See how it goes? Now, there's another piece of this story, because Ganesha's baby's head is missing. Can't fence the object. Demons bring him to Bhutanata, Bhutapati. They bring him to Ayappa. Where else? It's deep in the forest. He's the Lord of ghosts. Iapa takes the decapitated head. What does Iapa do with it? This is even better. Iapa, of course, knows what to do with it. Now, it's a very, very old idea. And it's pre-liberation. It goes back to Vedic ritual. In the Vedic ritual, the reason, this goes back to those people who were sojourning, and they don't build temples, they stop and build fire rituals. So you see things called Homa or Agni Homa, like the big fire sacrifices you see, they do them in temples now, but they weren't first done in temples. So the Vedic gods were invisible, and you made offerings to them, and they go up as smoke, and they come down as rain, and the whole event happens in a fire pit, right? Because the fire cooks, and the fire burns, and the fire transforms. But the Vedic ritual was a celebration both of the gods and the defeat of the demons. But when you defeat the demons, the first thing you did in an old Vedic ritual is when you were building the fire pit, which is still done, we'll do it in the temple, I'll show you when they do this. They're going to build it temporarily. It's not going to be here all the time. They're going to build a brick, it's called a hoven. They're going to build a brick oven, and they're going to lay it with sand. But underneath the sand, they're going to take a clay pot. And on the clay pot, they're going to take black calorium. They're going to burn the sacred grass. Tomorrow we get a story about the sacred grass and how it turns into this black soot. And they're going to mix it with ghee, and they're going to turn it into coal. They're going to turn it literally into eyeshadow. And this is the whole history of eyeshadow is woven into this story. I'm happy to tell you that too. Like, it's literally the history of eyeshadow. Why women wear eyeshadow, what eyeshadow is, why you would shadow the eyes, and why that would be beautiful. It all has to do with transmuting death into beauty, darkness into light. Because you look at the eyes, because now they're made up. You look into the darkness and you see brighter light, right? So we can go back to that. There's really a history of this, and the whole history of the words are all connected to the history of this invention. They take this black stuff and they paint a face, an Ugramukha, like a grumpy puss is what I translate that. It means ugly face or fearsome face or ferocious face. They paint a grumpy face on a pot and they crack the pot. And it stands for the decapitated head of the enemy. They put that in the bottom of the fire pit and put sand on top. Now they're going to light that fire with wood, and then they're going to actually light it with cow dung, and then they're going to feed the fire. Going to give it ghee and fruit and everything. And all the offerings that go up by Agni, who's the Agni Ignis fire, right? The messenger of the god is going to take them to the gods as smoke. But what's in the bottom of the pit? The decapitated head. And who gets fed? The demons. The demons get fed, right? So if Iapa is given this decapitated head, what's he going to do with it? He's going to put it in the bottom of a fire pit. Of a sacrifice. And when he makes the offerings to the gods and the smoke goes up to the gods, who gets fed? The decapitated baby head that was Pilayar, that was Ganesha, which means that that head doesn't become a hungry demon. So why is Ganesha such a sweet god? And the answer is he ain't in it alone. He's got Murga behind the reeds going, don't mess with the big guy. And his shadow, his lost piece, his vacated head, which could be a hungry, displaced, horrible thing, an irreparable wound, has now in the care of his brother, who knows that it is irreparably damaged. So anything that's irreparably damaged, you can call a demon in your life. That's not a bad thing. We all have irreparably damaged things. And the answer is, Iapa is feeding the demon, which further sweetens Ganesha. You get it? Because he's got somebody taking care of all of these other things that you don't see. So Ganesha is the lord of Dharma. He holds the world together. He's the big thing in the room. Murga, Skanda, is the lord of Maya. Maya is the measure of things. It's the illusion you need to keep things true. So the threat of violence is like an illusion. You don't want it to come true, but you need it because people need illusions in order to live. We can talk about that more tomorrow. We need illusions to live because we can't live in reality. We can only live in illusions of reality. We need the illusions too. got two more minutes for me to do the illusion, why you need an illusion. It's an easy one. I like this one a lot. It's the equation of time problem is an excellent example. We're actually coming up. What day is it? It's April 16th is the next equation of time. Okay, so think about it this way. I'm stretching you because it's 7:18, right? And everybody's got to go. Bear with me one more second. Is it really 7:18? The days are getting longer, right? The days are getting longer. So we deal with time as if it were a circle. We go 24 hours in every day, right? But when the Earth's closer to the sun, there are less than 24 hours in every day. When the Earth's farther away, the days are longer. The days are shorter because the Earth spins more slowly. Get it? So draw an ellipsis and draw a circle. There are only four times in the year, four times, four pillars, four elephants, four elephant legs, only four times in the year when midnight is actually midnight. Get it? Because every other time it's a little behind or a little ahead. Because we can't live in what time is it really. We live in it's 7:18. Get it? So we live in the illusion because we can't cope with reality. Because we'd have to wake up every day and we would be, and only four times of the year would we actually be on time on a 24-hour day. So it's exactly the same point. So mudra is you live in the illusion in order to address reality. The illusion is a round clock. The reality is elliptical time. See how it works? So you need the illusion in order to cope with reality. Ayapa, Dharmashasta, Shasta, the third brother. He's going to be the lord of the ghosts. He's going to preside over Chaya, Dharma, Maya, Chaya, the shadow. Because he's unseen. He's the one hiding away. And you need a keeper of secrets. You need someone who doesn't divulge. You don't need someone who's hiding and threatening and holding up Dharma. You need Dharma's black ops. You need this guy in the forest who's got your demons. You need the guy in the forest who knows that when you go to battle and do the right thing, you're going to come home PTSD'd and he's going to listen. So the entire construct of Mahaganapati depends on all three brothers. Get it? We need a Dharma life because we need to like get up and go to work in the morning, deal with our children, do the right thing, hold the world together. We need a Maya life because we all live in illusions and fantasies and hopes and wishes and threats and opportunities. Right? We have aspirations. Those are all mudra issues. But we all have our deep, dark secrets. We all have Chaya, C-H-A-Y-A. Dharma, Maya, Chaya. To understand Mahaganapati is to understand that he is this wonderful, great, amazingly interesting character, because these two other guys literally have his head, and his back. Get it? Was this a good time? Now tomorrow, the Ganesha stories are really super fast. We're going to find out that he has one wife, two wives, who they are, how he gets married. He's going to have a real adult life, Ganesha, and it's going to be as messy as yours and mine. I hope we had a good time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to keep you.
I have a quick announcement about the morning. There will be a meditation class in here until 9:15, so please don't come early. Just be here at 9:30. We'll be ready to go. And we're meeting from 9:30 to 12, and then 1 to 3:30 tomorrow. These are different times than originally.
Thank you. We're trying to make up for Friday night. Thank you so much for your patience. Thank you for letting me keep you over. Did you get to your head story?
Yes.
That's it.
I was really
and you will find it nowhere else. And don't be telling it on the internet. I get to own this before you do, okay? Because Appa told me this a million years ago.
Absolutely. When are you going to tell us what happened to the elephant that they took the head from?
Yeah, he's in the bottom. He's holding the world together.
Oh, he's upside down. He's upside down.
Thanks, Donna. Thank you so much. Come again. Come in the summer if you can. Okay, good.
All right. I was waiting for that.
Did you get it?
I did.
It's a little satisfying.
I like what they are.
Like part of what the Tantric Ganapati does is he tells you things that you can't find out elsewhere.
Okay, now I heard. All right, see you later.
Yes, thank you.